welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. We have the full crew here today. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
EDF! EDF!
We have Adam Vitale.
Hello.
We have James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And we have Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
So we were putting together the podcast, our little outline for today. We're recording this on July 27th. It's been quite a quiet news week in terms of RPG releases, which you kind of expected as much. It's kind of a quiet time of the year in general. There is a lot of gaming news that we might kind of touch on in passing or as we discuss other related topics that we'll probably go into more casually here. But we were looking kind of at the outline docket. Not a lot of major releases. We had a couple that we have a couple features that we'll shout out. A lot of the earlier summer releases we've kind of covered on previous episodes of the podcast. Of course, we talked about Trails Through Daybreak a couple weeks ago, the Elden Ring DLC, a few other things. We're looking at the docket for this week, and it's we'll kind of play it by ear. We'll go a little bit more casually. We'll talk about, obviously, we have a couple cool features that have gone up on the site, lingering out of Anime Expo, especially one very, very cool opportunity that James had that we'll touch on here in a bit. We'll talk about a little bit of the, I'm sure we'll go into Evo talk, because we always seem to do that as was happening over the last week and a few announcements there. But on specifically the RPG front, out of all the games that we've been playing here as a group, the most relevant one is actually an unofficial release, but one that has been seeing a fair bit of, at least from my perspective, hype and excitement around it. And that is the release of a total conversion mod for Fallout 4 called Fallout London. And that released over the last couple of days. It had been delayed from its original slated release due to Bethesda deciding to update Fallout 4 like for the first time in 6 years. So it finally got its new release date, and I've been playing through that. We were looking through all the potential topics to start off the podcast with, and that seemed kind of like the one that was most relevant. So if no one minds, I'll go ahead and just kind of jump into that. I've been playing it for about, installed it 2 days ago, spent some time this morning and yesterday evening playing through it.
Yeah, the thing that I heard from it immediately is that people were saying this is a pain in the ass to set up on Steam, so a lot of people went with the GOG version. I'll follow up.
That's exactly what I did. So first of all, I downloaded the Steam version because I had played it back in 2015 or whatever, a while ago. There's two factors that make using the Steam version kind of tricky, at least to my experience, is that you have to have the Game of the Year version or the equivalent, as in like you buy all the DLC, and then you've got to roll back your version to the prior to the most recent update.
Okay, so I've actually had to deal with the same shit recently. Well, recently is relative, but when I got my Quest 3, I decided to try out like some Fallout 4 VR, and to get and all of the DLC working, you can get it in there if you have the Game of the Year edition, but the files are only compatible with the older version, not the update. So I had to roll back and download all the DLC that way and then just drop it in the VR versions like a folder like manually. So it's I'm guessing yeah. Very similar deal.
Yeah, so I started doing that. Like I put like the DLC that I was because I had the two major pieces of DLC. I had like the what is it called? Far Harbor and Nuka World. But like apparently in order to get it to work right, you need the Game of the Year edition, which includes like packs of items and cosmetics and things like so I started like looking at that, and then you had to go to Nexus Mods and grab like the team's de-updater or whatever they call that downgrader, and then I just thought, or I could just go to GOG and pay $15 for the GOG version and then just download the mod and play it. So like now I just own two digital copies of the game because time is money. I don't know, I didn't want to deal with the headache,
right? Yeah,
like
yeah.
Oh, it's so easy to install if you know anything about computers. And then you go to the Reddit and people are like, I can't get it to work. It's not working right. And I'm just like, I don't want to deal with that.
By the time you get it up and working on Steam, you'll be so exhausted already that you don't feel like playing it. I get it.
That was exactly me with Fallout 4 VR.
Yep. So I grabbed the version on GOG and it's and Steam does support this too. So it'd be cool if they were able to package it on Steam. Like it's probably like 6 or 7 years old now, but Enderal is a very highly rated Skyrim mod, which is packaged on Steam, is just like, hey, you can download this and play this if you own Skyrim Special Edition or whatever. So GOG is kind of the same way. It's just like, hey, you purchase Fallout 4 from us, and then you purchase, or you purchase, quote unquote, you just, it's free, of course, this mod, and then you just install it and then you just play it. It's been a while since I've played a Fallout game. I've still not even watched the Amazon show, though. I've had friends who aren't even Fallout fans speak very highly of it. So, you know, if non-Fallout nerds really like the show, it's kind of a testament to like, okay, they were able to like reach outside of that audience. So I'm excited to see that at some point. I downloaded the mod, I got it all working, and I started playing it. Like I said, I put maybe about 12 total hours into it. I am not, like, I can't speak to canon accuracy, lore accuracy. Does this actually fit? I'm thinking it more of as like a anime OVA movie. Like, it might not slot in anywhere, but if, as long as it gets like the same feeling across, the same kind of like vibe across, I'm okay with it. I'm not going to scrutinize it like, well, actually this couldn't happen because of ABC. And I'm not even the authority to speak on that anyway. It starts out with a pretty simple premise, and a lot of the story premises so far are simple, but I'm not saying that in kind of like a disparaging way. Like, you are a test subject, you wake up in kind of a tube, and you're in like some underground facility where there's this guy named Smythe, who's like a very like smarmy scientist engineer dude who has machinations at work, and you don't know what he's working on, but a bunch of like mobsters effectively break into the place, and they're not intending to break you out. They're there trying to steal something, and you're not sure what, and you're kind of caught in the crossfire. You kind of end up breaking out, escaping. And then a lot of the theming around this mod is subways and trains. And I'm not sure like specifically if that's coming to a point. It's an interesting theming and it works just fine. But you get on a train and it crashes, and that's kind of like the start of the game. That's where you get the title screen and things like that. And you're basically wake up in the middle of London. And at that point, it's pretty like open-ended in terms of like go anywhere, do anything. In a way that's both kind of cool but also frustrating. So let me try to tee it up. So you run into the mobsters that originally broke into the underground facility that you were being tested on. You don't have memory. You also have like a few illnesses or like things wrong with you that you, it's like one of your earlier quests is like you have to see a doctor because you're dealing 10% less damage and you're taking 10% more damage because you don't know what the hell they were doing to you. And I haven't gotten far enough in the game to figure that out yet. So basically, you kind of have this overarching quest, like you got to figure out A, who you are, why they're testing you, and B, heal yourself. But also, these mobsters are like, hey, you can either follow us, we know the lay of the land around here, or you can go to a town nearby called Thameshaven. There might be a doctor there. They're the one that gave us the info on the base, so that you might be able to find some information there. And then it puts a little marker on your map, and you don't have a Pip-Boy. You have something called an Attaboy. It's like a Walkman or like a tape deck. Which they animated this in a pretty interesting way, where obviously since you don't have it on your wrist, they actually pull it out of your pocket and it shows them like pressing like a big clunky play, record, rewind, like a VCR buttons, like a Walkman. And like the way they animated it is actually like a lot of
our younger audience is like, what's a Walkman?
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about that. No, okay, you have to explain a lot what a Walkman is. Fuck.
Well, the thing is that like there's like modern Walkmans that are like iPods too, but like it's got the big chunky buttons that like press and depress all the way in on the sides.
The good shit.
Yeah. And like you find some little cutesy notes that say like, so we found some Pip-Boys from some people that came over from the States. I don't want my workers wearing this. You know, it's going to affect, you know, if they're wielding weapons, they can't have this clunky thing on their wrist. I'm going to create something different. We're going to call it the Attaboy. And it's something that attaches to like your hip. And it's like, okay, that's fine. That kind of fits the vibe and it kind of differentiates it. And I guess before I go into like, I don't want to like review this game as like in a standard fashion, because it is a fan mod. This, you know, a team of, I don't even know how many people made this in their free time over the last couple of years. The fact that they were able to even just get something shipped and for the most part working is astounding. Like, this is,
I have a clearly quick question.
Yeah.
Has this mod team like done anything else? Like, or is this like their first kind of project together? Sometimes you get these teams that like have worked on other mods elsewhere.
Obviously, I can't speak to like individual contributors in the team, but the team is called Team Fallout London, Team Fallon, F-O-L-O-N.
Oh, so like, this it's is not like Sure AI grouping. Okay, I got it.
Yeah. So, and I'm not sure if maybe there's a core nucleus that worked on something else, but this is Team Fallout London. They made this. So, it's,
do you know like when this was project. Announced? Like, or like when was the first time you heard of this project? Because I'm trying to get a timeline of how long this has been.
I first heard of it like 6 months ago. So, okay. But apparently it's been worked on since like 2019 or so. And I don't know that for sure. So don't be like, well, actually it was 26. Mm-hmm. But like how a lot of these go, at least like things that I've seen, is that they'll do an introductory trailer saying this is our idea, our concept. And then a lot of projects die, a lot of projects morph, or they change in scope. Because I remember seeing trailers for like Fallout Miami. I don't know what happened to that project. Maybe it released, maybe it didn't. Like I just never heard from it again from my vantage point. Obviously there's like Sky Oblivion and Sky Morrowind, like where they put like they put older games in newer engines, or in some cases newer games and older engines. Like we're gonna put Morrowind in the Skyrim engine, or we're gonna put Daggerfall in the Skyrim engine, or we're gonna put Skyrim in the Daggerfall, you know, or and then Fallout has similar things, and then you just never hear from again. But this one, it's kind of the opposite, where I didn't notice it when it was first announced, but I think the Fallout show, obviously the update, like the next gen update to the games, Fallout 76 got its second like expansion announced. There's just kind of like Fallout vibe. So I think the team Fallout London kind of, there was a little bit of luck involved. They were kind of in the right time, in the right place, right time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, okay. Fallout is in the Bethesda's not working on a Fallout game. Fallout 76 is still around, but it's been around for a while. It's not a new thing, though. Apparently, it's still kind of on the up and up in terms of player base. But here's a new game, quote unquote, from that. If you already own Fallout 4, you might be able to play this, though it might be easier if you just purchase it on GOG. I've played games where you boot up your old character. Like for instance, this is kind of a couple years ago, another mod for Fallout release called Fallout the Frontier. But how it worked was that you would boot into an existing character and then like go on a train and it would take you to a new place. This is kind of different, where this is like a separate story entirely just built on top of the Fallout 4 engine. Now, Fallout the Frontier, unfortunately, had a lot of shenanigans go down when it was released, and they're still trying to, I think, in some ways, rebuild that or rework it in some ways. So that's its own separate topic. The thing that I really enjoy so far about Fallout London is that Fallout the Frontier, and I think I've seen other fan mods, they try to go too big to something that doesn't work. Like in Fallout the Frontier, it played often like it was a first-person shooter, like a Call of Duty game. Like they were having you do like turret sequences and way more enemies on screen than the game was ever initially meant to handle. And for spectacle, sure, it's fine, but it just doesn't fit like the movement, the speed, the stats. It just felt like it was shoehorned in, a square peg in a round hole. Where Fallout London doesn't do that. It's just like, hey, here's another map. It's like the Capital Wasteland in 3, or the Commonwealth in 4, or the you know, Mojave Desert in New Vegas. Only, and they dot the map with points of interest. These are like old railway stations or abandoned restaurants or subways or city halls. So it feels very typical Fallout. You'll find like the Wasteland Raiders in this game are called hooligans. There's a lot of British themed things, and I can't comment those because I'm not a British person. But I'll talk about those a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's feral ghouls. You do find a race of mutants underground, and they kind of seem like they have like, they're not ghouls, they're mutants, so they have like a completely different aesthetic to them. They're friendly, so that's kind of like it's their take on someone else, on another like population of people that have been affected by the war and things like that. I will say though that on a gameplay front, it almost feels kind of survival horror early on, because early on you're given like a knife and a pistol, and then you're like, okay, here's this waypoint pretty far across the map. It'll probably take you a good 20 minutes to walk there, and you're going to run into like a lot of points of interest on the way. But you're pretty weak. You don't have any healing items. Your armor sucks. So you kind of have to play very carefully early on. And there was a few times where I ran into a place and I'm like, oh, I can take out a few raiders, and then all of a sudden there's a glowing feral ghoul, and I'm like, nope, I can't do that. So you actually, and I'm stubborn, so I'm like, maybe if I just get a crit on him, or maybe if I sneak around him, or maybe if I, and then you just have to like admit defeat and be like, I'm not sure what the best point of comparison would be, but like there's no natural scaling, which felt like it was a bigger topic in like 15 years ago, where as far as I can tell anyways, it's like, nope, that guy is too strong for me. I don't have the gear or the perks or the talents needed to do that. So I need to go the other direction and just try to come back later, which is kind of hard for me to do. But then once you do it, it does feel rewarding. Like, aha, I found something that is a little bit more on my level. Things that I appreciate about the mod is that they animated a whole new set of like cartoons and like perk animations, and like if you've ever played a Fallout game, you open up the perk screen and it's the vault boy, and he's doing like things that represent what the perk is. Like he might be carrying extra bags if you're doing a perk that increases your carry capacity, or if you're doing like a hacker perk, he'll be at a computer. They made custom versions of that with a completely different set of cartoons, so that's just like a lot of like attention to detail there that I thought was really cool. A lot of the perks kind of have the same flavor as existing Fallout perks. It feels very natural. It doesn't feel like completely out of left field. Like you still have perks that say you scrounge more materials or more ammunition out of containers, or trade prices are better, or damage with automatic weapons or you do plus 20% or things like that. So it's very, very typical, but in a way that I appreciate actually, because it feels like, oh, this is truly feels like a Fallout DLC. There are some places where, you know, you can see the creases. Like for instance, one thing that was frustrating me last night was there's a quest where you're on a ferry boat and this guy is trying to take you across the shore. And so I don't know if the engine was ever intended to do that, because this is like the typical game brio engine stapled together thing that Bethesda has kind of constantly been kind of at fault for. I don't know if fault's the right word, but it's a well-worn, well-known thing that the engine has its quirks. So I'm riding on this boat with this guy trying to take me across the shore, and then as soon as I get to the other end, I fall through the boat, and I'm just like, of course that would happen. Yeah, like, and like I googled like on Reddit, like, I keep falling through the boat, how do I fix this? And then people are like, yep, that's happening to me too, just enable god mode and no clip mode and you're fine. I'm like, oh, of course that's how you fix this. and there's a few other things like that's silly, and I'm sure like over time they'll polish it up. Mm-hmm. But if there's a few other things where like a lot of things are themed around, you know, Britain or London. So like you'll grab something and in your UI it's called Bangers and Mash. And like, okay. And it gives you a lot of health. Like, aha, that's on, you know, on par. But then the actual item still says sugar bombs, which is a normal Fallout item. Yeah, in your UI it says Bangers and Mash. And then there's a few things where you pick up a document and it says like London Police Report or whatever. And then like if you inspect it, it says it's a magazine of Grognak the Barbarian, which is a Fallout item. So and the thing is like, work smarter, not harder. Like those things are usually in your inventory 92% of the time. All you're going to see is it's listing in your inventory. So if it's called Bangers and Mash and you're using it to heal yourself, that's fine. If you inspect it and the box physically in world still says sugar bombs, not a big deal, but it is something you notice. The only thing I will say that is like, I don't want to say it's disappointing, because again, this is a passion project, but a lot of the locations very clearly, like you go into an abandoned restaurant, you fight your way around some bloat flies or whatever, and then you find like one safe at the very end once you follow the path through, or you'll find like one magazine on a table once you work your way through the enemies. And then once you pick that up, usually these locations only have like the one thing that's there. So it's very clearly like, oh, I got the thing here. I can leave now. There's nothing else to see. And the team has done a really good job, like putting a lot of new assets in places, really making it feel like you're walking down the rubble of a destroyed huge city, which London is, of course. But sometimes it feels like it's full of stuff, but there's nothing in it, if that makes sense. Like there's like rubble and there's like broken buildings and there's collapsed bridges, but there's nothing to see or do in a lot of the places. It does sell the environment really well, but unless it's an interior location with a named thing on your map, very rarely or often I find that there's just nothing there. It makes me appreciate like what Bethesda does do to their worlds to make them so big, but also give them like a lot. You feel like you're doing a lot, maybe, you know, Starfield excluded because the design was slightly different there. So there is that, but I don't really mind it that much because I'm just kind of focusing on the story and the gameplay and like trying to figure out how I want to build my character. I almost always build my character like a melee sneaky guy. So I'm actually going to be like, all right, I'm gonna use heavy armor and automatic weapons. It does feel kind of neat. Like right now I'm kind of like a hodgepodge of like gear, like random hooligan left vest or sentry bot boots. And then I found a cape. So I'm wearing a cape and then I've got like a miner's hat on. So I look like,
just look like a nightmare, like any other Fallout character pretty much.
Yeah. And I'm using like a pipe automatic pistol that looks like it'll fall apart at any moment. But nice. For some reason I was able to take it to a workbench and now it does a lot of damage because I've perked into it a little bit. I guess what I'm going to say is it's a very surprisingly polished package for what it is. But also it is built on top of Fallout 4 made by, fans in their spare time. So like, if you go in with those expectations, I think you should have a good time. If someone goes in and they say like, well, this is going to be my substitute for Fallout 5 or whatever, because Bethesda's not working
that's
on
ridiculous.
It. Well, no. And like, that seems obvious, but some people are like, I saw some people on the comments saying like, how come the graphics look so like dated? I'm like, it's built on an engine that was never like a showstopper in terms of like, gee whiz, wow.
Even when Fallout 4 came out, like, it wasn't like the, like, people didn't praise Fallout 4 for its like graphics or anything when it came out.
Yeah, it's not going to blow your mind that way, but it's not going to blow your mind visually, but it does kind of blow my mind just like, again, just the ambitions of the team, the fact that they're able to put this together. The fact that it is like, I've played other mods where it's very, very linear there's very clearly like, you do something the way that they don't intend and it breaks very easily in terms of like quest logic. And I mean, we're here. I haven't run into that yet. And I'm sure there's places where that will happen because even fully released paid products do that, but just I'm enjoying my time with it. It's a nice taste of like, here's something Fallout that's new. As long as you're not overly concerned about polish and as long as you're not overly concerned about canon, I suppose. I think you'll have a good time with it. Oh, and I guess it has voice acting, and the voice acting is not great, but it's fine. I think it's on par or better than Underall.
Yeah, I was going to ask kind of like if it did have voice acting or voice dialogue, and were there like any sort of like mannerisms or colloquialisms in terms of like, were there any terms that like just threw you off because you don't have like British slang, like, an understanding of British slang, I guess.
Not really, but I mean, there's a lot of British accents, and I don't know like the difference between like Cockney and the different. I don't know the different boroughs. Like, I don't know that very well, so I don't know. Maybe we got to get Alex or CD on here to speak to like the representation. Like, no one living near the Tower of London would have that accent or whatever. But it's been fine. Like, it doesn't take me out of the moment. And I guess one other thing is that the protagonist in this game is a non-voice protagonist, so more like Fallout 3 or New Vegas and not like Fallout 4. So you will choose your dialogue from a list of options, not from a radio menu. When you make a choice, you don't hear your character say that choice. It's just immediately implied that you said that thing, which is how I prefer it. I know some people would rather have it more like The Witcher or Mass Effect or Fallout 4, where you pick your choice and then the character would speak. The character doesn't speak, which is how I prefer it, but if it's not that, that's how they have set it up. You can play it in first person or third person, which the third person's a little bit janky, but some people prefer that because it makes them, for accessibility reasons. So there is that. I think I kind of covered all the basics. I haven't played it to completion, so I don't know like how long it takes to A, beat the story, or B, see everything. But it's a good size map. My compass is full of like points of interest, like in terms of like the different icons that they, if you've played Skyrim or any Bethesda game in the last 15 years, Starfield, it works the exact same way. The UI is customized a little bit, so it's a little bit more of a modern UI. So I haven't played vanilla Fallout 4 in a while, so I don't remember all the features that were added to it versus stuff that's modded in after the fact.
Did they add any custom music tracks, or is it just like holdovers from Fallout 4?
There are a couple. There's some radio stations, and I don't like. I listened to a couple of them, but I don't remember if it's from Fallout 4 or not. The combat music definitely feels different and new, though. I think it's a little bit like overly bombastic. Like, it's a pretty high intensity combat theme, but I'm fighting like rad rats. And it's like, I'm shooting like little rad rats and take one shot each. And I'm like, okay, you could have like ramped into this rather than going whole hog on the very first fight in the sewers in the game. Oh, and there are this is very specific, but there's a type of enemy in the game called leeches. And I'm trying to remember if they're in Fallout 4 or not, or in Far Harbor or whatever. But they're gross. They're giant leeches, like black with like the round mouths, and they like jump at you and like, like sort of thing. And like, it's like gross in a good way. Like they really nailed the animations on those. And maybe those are from base game and I don't remember them. So whoever designed
Dragon's
those.
Dragon's Dogma leeches?
They're, yeah. Well, I'm trying to remember the Dragon's Dogma leeches, how big they are.
Oh, they're pretty big.
It's hard to say because I play this in first person, so it's like they're like 6 feet long and they're like 2 feet wide. I don't know. They're big.
Very cute. But yeah.
I'm just flashing back now to like the little small starting enemies you run into, like Xenoblade 2, and then the music going hog wild. Combat encounters. It's like, dude, it's like a little tiny, like the equivalent of like a Dragon Quest slime, and then the music's going.
Classic RPG problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm having a good time. It's definitely like between, I just finished Shadow of the Erdtree. I have a few releases in August that I'm interested in. So it felt like a good weekend for me to be like, all right, you know, this game just came out. It's pretty vogue. People seem to be thinking fairly highly of it, though it does have some, you know, it's buggy. But I've played these games before. New Vegas is not well regarded despite it being buggy as all hell, so that's not going to stop me, and I'm having a good time with it.
Maybe I'll in terms of what I was going to say was, in terms of official like Fallout releases, obviously we had the show, and I know like Fallout 76 has been updated, but if people are like looking for like a new Fallout game, it's going to be a while for like a new official game, because I assume they're going to be, Bethesda is doing Starfield DLC. That's coming out relatively soon. And then Elder Scrolls, I think, is next. And then Fallout would be after that. So that might be like a decade away. I don't know. Close to one.
Anyway. Like the only oddly feasible thing like that could happen is like if like Microsoft gets like some other team to like maybe do like remasters or remakes of like older Fallout game.
Right.
Or some.
And we've talked about this before. They have Obsidian under their wing, and they have an Exile, who is sort of Interplay under their wing. It's like they have those. They have kind of weirdly brought together like these desperate Fallout developers all together under Microsoft and Bethesda now. But anyways, it is going to be a while before the next like new Fallout game. That's where these sorts of fan mods can be an interesting diversion, I guess.
So I found a post. This is a Yahoo tech post from January talking about the most ambitious and interesting Fallout mods in development. And it says Fallout London, release date April. And that was its original release date. Fallout Cascadia, time in development 7 years, release date unknown. Fallout Miami, time in development 5 years, release date unknown. And I'm not blaming that because games are hard to make and people are doing this on their free time. It's just that these things take a while to make. Fallout New Vegas is being ported into Fallout 4, so Fallout 4 New Vegas. Capital Wasteland, which I assume is Fallout 3 New Vegas, but I'm not sure. And all of those say estimated release date, none. So Fallout Miami, though, still has recent updates and streams to the YouTube channel, so they're still plugging away at that. So long story short, there might be other things sprinkled out through over the next couple of years while we wait for an official title. But I would be totally on board with an isometric Fallout from Interplay or Obsidian.
I think the most reasonable next Fallout thing is a new season of the Fallout show.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and also there's like I said, 76, which I used to play pretty religiously, but haven't in like a year and a half, is getting its second big update at some point. I forget the date on that. So maybe I'll reinstall it. I don't know. With that, the second game that we had listed to talk about today is another late July release that is not an official RPG, not an RPG at all. We're going to be talking about Earth Defense Force 6.
That's right.
So, I don't know anything about this other than it involves shooting bugs.
Okay, you're getting it.
I've seen the local Chinatown guy always shill for this series back in the day.
So what do you mean the local Chinatown guy?
Okay, so in my area, there's a Chinatown that's like, I don't know, 20 kilometers away. You go there, there's a model shop that sells Gundam models, but they also have a TV set up, and they would like boot up import games. So the guy always boot up like Earth Defense Force, and we're like, why not play it like something else? And this guy always shill for the series.
Because that guy plays soulful games, unlike everything else you want them to play. They actually play good games, Chow. They're like, I can understand.
Oh, this Chinatown guy is a true master. I can't beat him in fighting games.
See, he knows. So look, I don't know this person, but I already have like the highest utmost respect. So Earth Defense Force 6, it initially came out in Japan like 2 years ago, so it's finally getting its official Western release here. I know it got like a Southeast Asian English release some time ago, but aside from that, it came out here on PC and I think PlayStation platforms. I don't know if it's anywhere else aside from them. But it's you know, Earth Defense Force, you kind of know already what you're signing up for if you played this, played any of these releases. It is, hey, you're picking one out of four classes of like this Ranger, which is their typical soldier class, that has grenades, assault rifles, shotguns, and has some new expanded capabilities here in the sixth entry, where they can like call down vehicles, turrets, and so forth. Which is, the calling down vehicles is something that the Air Raider does, which is another class in this game. And Air Raider is kind of the most inconsistent class in the series, where in terms of like what its functions are, because it classically it's like one of those classes where like it would call down the vehicles and so forth that other people can use alongside them, but now the Ranger can too. So the Air Raider in this game is very drone focused, where it has like different kinds of drones that like you place beacons on enemies and you set, and the drones are deployed and sent out to deal damage. They also have the classic role of like calling down like bomber strikes and gunships and so forth. Then you have the wing diver class, which has like a jetpack on them, and then a lot of their weaponry is energy focused. So they have like crazy laser focus, like something you'd see like in like Gundam games, honestly, of like split lasers, just lots of like heavy support fire from like laser based energy based weaponry. And they have like the highest mobility out of the class selection because of their jetpack. And you have the Fencer. Fencer is like kind of like, I guess you would call it like the heavy class, where they have like crazy like minigun weaponry. They also have the ability to like kind of like the boost and dash around in short spurts. Their mobility in EDF 6 is a little bit expanded in terms of like they can now like have up to two like dashes and jumps, which is, you know, in older entries they'd be kind of more clunky to move around in, because their mobility is so it's reduced compared to the other classes. While in this game it does have a little bit more expanded ones. It gets so minute to the form in terms of like in older EDFs, the Ranger and the Air Raider would have the base ability to like hop through like low obstacles like fences and so forth, but the Fencer couldn't. So playing the Fencer would be annoying because you couldn't hop over like small obstacles. While in EDF 6, they now finally can, and that's like a huge thing for Fencer players. It's like, oh my god, they can do that now. And it's like, you know, it sounds stupid to like outside people, but it's like, it's a big deal for in terms of like just having that like small quality of life mobility thing on them. That's kind of has been like the four base classes for quite a while. And EDF, they're back here, and it's kind of an interesting package because they have this ongoing storyline, and Earth Defense Force 6 actually is a direct sequel to the follow-up, the finale of Earth Defense Force 5, where there's like this alien invading race called the Primers, and you fend them off at the finale of EDF 5 with their motherships and so forth. And this one, it starts off with like this ruined landscape, like this ruined city, like Earth has been kind of just been ruined from like all this ongoing war and invasions from like these multiple other, you know, alien invaders. So I can't remember the last time we're in EDF games, like first mission, like the first enemies you see aren't gigantic bugs. In this one, it's the gigantic frog invaders that were introduced in EDF 5, and it's interesting just playing this kind of game because it's very, very heavy on like, hey, you're fighting gigantic enemies and you can just pretty much mutilate them with your weaponry, like cut off limbs. So like there's even a tactical aspect with like these frog invaders have like this big gun that like it's like a shotgun blast that does like a good chunk of damage to you, but you can actually like, you know, target that arm render that their capacity to fire it useless because you can like just chunk off the arm that is holding these guns, these shotguns and so forth. And there's a lot of like, you know, ragdoll physics associated with both you and the enemies and so forth. Obviously the bugs come back at a certain point early on as well. It's stupid to kind of compare them because EDF has long, you know, existed before Helldivers, but you know, a lot of people will draw comparisons to Helldivers too. Especially with some headlines earlier this
when
year,
Brian mentioned shooting bugs, I was this close to making a Helldivers joke, but I didn't.
I know, but you know,
yeah, I actually was too, but I didn't want to be the guy where I was like, I get boss baby vibes from this or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, like you already saw the headline earlier this year with the Helldivers 2, like Earth Defense Force. You know, it's personally it irks me, but I get it why people would compare it to Helldivers. Because it's very popular and successful. But in this game, it's way more straightforward than Helldivers in the sense that you're not inputting commands to go call for like support and like get your weaponry and stuff like that. It's like you equip it onto your character before you launch into a stage. So like if I'm a ranger, I equip them with say like a helicopter or a tank. So when a mission starts, you can call that immediately, like helicopters. And then, but some others, like the anti-air vehicle, you need to, like, kill a certain amount of enemies to charge up the spar to call it down, and so forth. So, you know, it does have, but there's not, like, something you have to, like, input a sequence for, you know, to enable to call down that sort of stuff, like in Helldivers. And unlike Helldivers, it's all very, it's not like you're exploring, like, different objectives. Your objective in every fucking stage is kill all the enemies, you know? That is your basic objective. You're not, like, holding down a point for a certain amount of time. You're not, like, trying to get research data and deliver it to someplace else, like in Helldivers. It's very straightforward action, arcade, you know, sort of stages. But the enemy types, the enemy type variety is, like, kind of where the Helldiver are. Where Earth Defense Force has the leg up on Helldivers because this is a series that has like gone on for so many years, so they've had a lot of time to like kind of build up the amount of enemy variety they've had over what Helldivers has had. So you have like, you know, just the frog aliens, but then you have different variations of the frogs where they're wearing armor. Some of them are like kind of kamikaze esque, where they're like holding up like grenades, so they're like running towards you to like blow up. Then you have like variants of like that, like androids that are like, some are like the types that are like kind of like the grunt type androids, but some are like the heavier types where like it takes more shots to bring them down. You'll have like robots that are like shaped like the EDF soldiers, so that are like, but like gigantic versions of you, but are like robots. Of course, you have like all the different types of like bugs. You have like the basic like silver ants, then you have the red ants, then you have the green ants. You'll have like very bizarre flying creatures, like flying frogs that have like wings on them. Then you'll have like the UFO, the different UFO types. So you have all these different kinds of like enemies that like, you know, you've seen throughout the series, plus they'll have like new ones added on and so forth. And then you'll even have like special types like the Godzilla type enemy, I think called like Era Gun or Arrow, I forget what it's called. That you'll encounter later on. You'll have the mother type ants that are like a bitch to take down. So where it kind of has a leg up in terms of like Helldivers is that enemy variety and that whole mutilation system where it's kind of more, it's more scrappy, but it's more old school, like that ragdoll physics of like, hey, this ant is like, it bit me, so you're like kind of firing at it to like make it stop biting you, then like it'll fling you to like the other like 300 feet in the air, you know, so you're like your body's just ragdolling to the ground, you know, and so forth. So it's all good fun. And then like as you're killing enemies, you'll have the classic EDL, like you'll have different drops where, you know, you're picking up health, you're picking up weapons that you know, that'll either upgrade what you already have to like upgrade their stats, or you'll get like new weapons or new weaponry, new like support equipment, like those vehicle drops or sort of like, or other things to your class where like some classes can like help throw down a health beacon and that'll gradually provide health to like nearby allies. And then you'll have permanent like armor upgrades. So you have like armor boxes that you pick up, and then that's kind of like the one ongoing thing that you're buffing throughout the game is like your maximum health cap, which is through armor. And every class has different armor caps that you're gradually, you know, increasing through by picking up these armor pickup enemies and so forth. So it's very classic EDF stuff. It does some really cool things because, as I mentioned early on, like you have this ruined landscape, but it's like it takes like a few stages for like the actual game to begin, where like you actually get the title drop of the game. So like maybe like by stage 13 or 14, you start getting a sense of like what the fuck is going on, and then like it actually time loops you back into like the events of Earth Defense Force 5. But so you have like kind of reused, remixed stages from Earth Defense Force 5 in this game with like very similar dialogue, but new enemy placements and types from existing EDF 5 stages, because it is a time loop story. And it kind of always has been for the enemies, where the enemies would actually employ time travel technology to put better enemies at key battles in history with humans, because like humans keep on wiping the floor with the aliens, so the aliens keep on time traveling back with better enemies to kind of thwart humanity from their inevitable loss against them. So now humans are like starting to employ like the time travel technology against like the aliens to send like more experienced veteran troops back in time, which is through the players, to thwart the aliens and so forth. So it the story is bonkers. It's never been like the focal point, but it is kind of interesting to see like how they employ like the time travel story into the gameplay itself, where you, the player, have already experienced this. Like you're the veteran and you're kind of re-experiencing remixed past stages with like more threatening enemy placements and so on. Of course, there's gonna be new stages that you encounter as well after like it you experience like the sixth time loop now in this game. So it gets, you know, pretty bonkers. But there has been controversy with this new release of EDF6, especially
before you go into the controversy, I just wanted to bounce off a few of the things that you talked about. Sure. There you were talking about, you went into pretty big detail on the sheer amount of enemy variety in the game, and due to the fact that it's a longer running series and they can kind of just add to the pile every iteration and then kind of just revamp based on legacy, whether it's like these frogs were introduced in the last game but now they're more prominent in this one, but also we had, you know, this type of enemy or this type of enemy and that. And I'm going to tie this all together, I promise. But after I finished Shadow of the Erdtree, I was just reading some reviews and like some impressions. And some people, like I saw, were bemoaning the lack of enemy variety. And then I know we've also had some similar conversations. Like I know when Adam was covering Banishers, he said that one of the, you know, negative points for him was just kind of a lack of enemy variety. And I saw like,
there were, some like four enemies in that game.
I saw some Reddit or Twitter comment saying like, well, why does enemy variety matter anyway? And it got me thinking just a little bit. It's like, well, you know, there's just a flavor aspect of it. If you have two types of enemies that fight you the same way and you approach the same way, but thematically or for the story or the narrative, it makes sense that it would make sense to have, you know, the old JRPG of the recolored enemy or whatever. Or in Elden Ring, you could say, like, this is a knight that works for a different lord, so they've got a different, you know, chest piece or cape or whatever. Or, like you said, different colors of ants. Like, that can serve a narrative purpose. Or, like, what you really touch on Earth Defense Force, a lot of these things you fight in different ways, or they fight you in different ways. And it's one of those things where, like, I thought, like, you know, enemy variety is almost always good. And I could see, like, some places where it might not be as important to criticize whether there's a lack of it or how much it matters in certain games. But I was just kind of thinking of the different contexts in which we've seen that discussion come up, where in most cases it does seem like enemy variety does lend itself to, you know, more story variety, more gameplay variety. It's in most cases a good thing. And this is really, it's cool to see that Earth Defense Force 6 is leveraging the fact that it's a longer running series to kind of make use of that from a specifically a gameplay focused perspective.
Yeah, and it really does it well in the sense of, like, because it's always been like has that B grade movie quality humor to it. It's very campy, kind of schlocky, but it doesn't make it that to the point that it's like it feels kind of cringy or like forced. It's very, because the people are so serious in this game of, like, the situation, but it comes off as, like, as a parody, you know, to like people who are onlooking. So, for example, when they introduced, like, these gigantic frog aliens for the first time, and when you're trying to describe it to, like, to your commander of what they look like, you're describing it as, like, a humanoid aliens, and your commander's like, so they, like, resemble humans, and it's like yeah, yes sir, it's like two eyes, two arms, two legs. It's like, oh my god, they're indistinguishable to humans, you know? They look just like us. It's like, yep, you nailed it, you know? So it has that, like, you know, it takes itself seriously, but to us, it's like, it's so absurd, but it comes off kind of charming and funny in that campy B-grade movie way. It's like, oh my, like, how are we going to fight against them? And they look just like us. It's like, yes, because the way that we're describing it to them is like, you know, like that, you know? So, like, I kind of love that about, like, the series in general. Like, it kind of balances the line, like, especially when people come to EDF. Like, a lot of the EDF community loves, like, that, like, you can make your troops, like, sing, like, the EDF, like, you know, song, you know? So, just in the middle of battle, you could, like, have, like, one of, like, the emote options, like, sing, and then, like, you have different song options, and then just in the middle of battle, you'll just have, like, voice songs from your troops, like, you know, just singing in battle, you know, like, this EDF.
That's almost always like the hardest tenor to land. Mm-hmm. Either it's super grim, dark, and serious, or it's super kitsch camp parody. But having something that kind of threads the needle and it just allows itself to be goofy in certain ways, it feels like that's more of a risk than going whole hog in either for other sure. direction.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I think EDF has such a loyal fan base. And that's why, like, you know, When things go wrong for EDF, especially, like, you know, what I'm about to get to, like, of course, it seems it hurts passionate fans the most because of people who, like, who've been with the series for, like, a long ass time. Like, I'm not, like, the biggest EDF fan, but, like, I have a lot of friends who love EDF and I, like, enjoy playing it with them. And so, because like, EDF kind of scratches that itch that even Helldivers 2 can't, where it has, like, has an absurd swarm of enemies and chaos going on at once. And Helldivers 2 definitely has that. But it feels, you know, like a higher, it feels overproduced in a sense where, like, it looks super pretty with, like, you know, the planet and the weather conditions and so forth. But it feels a little bit diluted because they only have so many enemy types to work with. While in EDF, you have, like, different colored ants, while you have, like, gigantic bees swarming, while you have, like, these androids at the other side of the stage, like, wreaking havoc. And it's just, like, it's just absolute chaos because, like, while all this is going on, you have, like, artillery barrages from, like, two air raiders. You have, like, a helicopter from a ranger just firing rockets. And you, like, this wing diver is just like, oh god, I have to go pick up, like, wing divers are kind of, like, silently, like, kind of like the people who, like, pick up boxes. So, like, as all these enemies are going down, you're trying to fend off your own, for your, like, you know, fend off your own life, along with like, oh shit, I have to go pick up all these like boxes that like people definitely have don't have like the mobility to like get to, while I do, you know. So like it's just absolute chaos on like on a really really crazy scale that like, you know, you do get some of that with Helldivers too, but it doesn't quite match how EDF can really encapsulate it, especially like in an isolated stage, you know. And this also has like full on destruction as well, so like you can like just level a whole city with like just artillery and so forth, while, you know, in Helldivers 2, you don't really have like the those city and urban landscapes that like where you can like kind of utilize the stage to your own advantage, because, you know, enemies can scale these buildings like ants, androids, they'll like they'll use the environment to their own benefit of like scaling up these buildings, and like some of like your troops might not have the weaponry to like reach them with their firearm and so forth. So what do? You bring the enemy to you by just blowing up that fucking building. So what are you gonna climb then if you have nothing? So it's been really really fun in that sort of way, but with the PC version of EDF6, it's not like that the devs are like being coy about it. But since this also released on the Epic Game Store, so they've utilized the Epic Online Services for their online infrastructure, which is they've never done before. It was always native to, like, you know, all the Steam releases had like the native Steam matchmaking and so forth. And just in game, you didn't have to like sign up for like an Epic Online account or anything like that. But with this one, you do. It's mandatory. If you want to play online, you need to have an Epic Games account. And that has like caused like a severe uproar, because, like, you know, a lot of EDF players, like, I had to go sign up for a service that I didn't want to use, you know. And like when you boot up this game for the first time, it does install Epic Online Services. And when you choose, like, you know, I want to play online, it says, hey, you have to go sign up for the Epic Game Store in order to do so.
I think so. And I think an extra wrinkle to this is that, from what I saw, there is a way to get Epic Online Services going where you still have to install it for crossplay, which I don't think that's the issue, the Epic Online Services stuff. It's the requiring an account, mm-hmm. when you can totally set it up where you don't need to do that but still get crossplay. And even worse, even though that they're doing this for crossplay between Epic and Steam, there's no crossplay between PlayStation and PC.
Yeah, if like the PlayStation, like the cosplays are separate, where like PlayStation can play between PS5 and PS4 players, but not PC. But with PC, you can play between Epic Game Store players and Steam, but not with PlayStation. So like there is quote unquote crossplay, but not between like only between platforms, not necessarily between only same platforms, but not between like different platforms. Now, it's not like PlayStation to PC, it's only PC to PC, PlayStation to PlayStation. That's the quote-unquote crossplay that you'll get out of it. So, like, it kind of, like, is a weird concession to that. And even then, like, the feedback has gotten so bad, like, D3 Publisher themselves had to, like, apologize, saying, oh, we didn't, like, inform you in advance that, like, you know, you'd have to do this, because they really did it. Like, the most you got was, like, I think maybe a week ago there was like a blog entry on Epic Game Store, but that's about it, and no one's reading that, you know, who cares?
So yeah, and I don't think the blog even mentioned that you need to have Epic Online Services installed. Like, from what I saw, the Steam page didn't list that requirement for the game until literally like half an hour before it went live.
Yeah, like
which, here's the funny thing about that. So the way it worked when it launched was you had to act, it prompted you to sign into Epic, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's something really funny about that, because like randomly they sent a code, and I installed it on my Steam Deck and I booted it up. It never once asked me to make an Epic account.
Like when you tried to go online, like with on your Steam Deck.
Well, no, when I booted it up.
So yeah, so that's the thing. When you boot it up, it'll it's not Epic Online Services, but like it only asks you to do the Epic sign in with when you click online mode. But if you just click single player offline,
gotcha. Yeah,
it won't ask you that. But only when you want to connect online, it'll ask you. But it's gotten to the point that like as of July 26th, the day before this podcast recording, D3 Publisher put up another Steam announcement. Saying that they're going to look into the development team for EDF6 at Sandlot. We'll look into, you know, finding a way to play this game online without having to make an Epic Games account, which is, you know, that's the thing that like people are most pissed off about. And that's kind of circling back to like, hey, having like kind of betraying like your most loyal players, like to a lot of people, especially on the outside. It's one of those things, like, why not just, it's harmless to make an Epic Game Store account. It takes, like, 2 seconds, right? And, yes, you do have a point with that. But for a lot of people, it's like, they don't want to have to, like, do, like, make another account for a service that they're never going to use. You know, and it's been proven before with Earth Defense Force on Steam that, like, you know, you didn't have to do this before. So why is the expectation now you have to do this when you've had... So many,
you know, it's really funny. It's really funny how this is another example of how, like, this is exactly like the Helldivers 2 situation with like the PSN requirement.
Yeah.
I was thinking the same thing right there.
Exactly. You know, and I don't know if there's like any region limitations for Epic Game Store, like citing on stuff. Like, I haven't really looked into that, but maybe that's also a factor in this as well, where like some regions may not be able to make an Epic Game Store account officially. I don't know. That might be a fall too.
This is sort of a weird tangent, but I think we won't bring it up later anyways. This is also earlier this week, BioWare and EA revealed that to play Dragon Age the Veilguard on Steam, you do not need to, it'll be native. No EA app.
Oh yeah, which is great, you know.
I know it's not like it's a single player game and not like online, but yeah, I've been playing a little bit of Dragon Age 2, and I know like Mass Effect Legendary Edition was the same way. And yeah, it's got that annoying EA app booting up in the background, and it's
not Origin anymore. It's weird, either, right?
It's just anymore. EA. It's called EA App now. It's not Origin anymore, although it's just it's pretty much the same thing. But yeah, it's a little bit weird and a little bit annoying. So
it's been a while since I've played a Ubisoft game, but like it seems like over the last 12 years they've gone back and forth. Like you can play this on Steam, but you have to have Uplay or whatever the hell they call it, Ubisoft Connect now, in the background. Oh, now it's natively on Steam. Oh, now it's only on Ubisoft. Oh, now you have to have both. Like, it just feels like there's no consistency.
Yeah, Ubisoft is especially especially bad because, like, I think they by and far have the worst, like, app on PC. Like, I have an issue where on my desktop, no matter how many times I completely, like, uninstall and clean install, like, Ubisoft Connect, it just randomly breaks. Like if I open up my task manager right now, I'll see it running. And if I turn it off and restart it, maybe it will like briefly show up for like a second. And then I won't see it anywhere, but it'll be on my task manager. And it's just like, okay, so what can I do with this? I literally can't do shit.
Yeah. So,
like,
yeah. Hopefully they find a way of in a reasonable time to, get this sorted out. You know, obviously as of this moment, you still need an Epic account mandatory to play online. It's like, other than that's like not a big deal to like matchmake with friends. Like the online play is fine. Obviously for like some more shadier connections or for like some more distant connections, then there might be a little bit of desync, but it doesn't like close down the game or anything. It's just like some teleporting. But either way, you're not like actively involving, like there's nothing intricate about the game itself that like you need to work together with a person to like do something. Like the most you would need is like, say you have a vehicle, you summon a vehicle, there's like two other slots for like gunner positions or so forth. That's like the most intricate. Other than that, like you're just kind of helping each other out, like kind of mitigate this like massive swarm of creatures from hell or high water, just survive, you know. And it delivers on that. There's nothing, even if like it's like, oh, I've never played an EDF game before. It's like, who, like, doesn't matter. You can just like hop into this one and just play and have fun. It's very mindless fun. It's just hop in, play. You don't have to worry about like, you know, there's no pesky games as a service mechanics with it. There's no battle pass. There's no daily login.
I was going to say, battle pass. You get, like, points that you fill up a bar and get cosmetics out of.
There's nothing like that. It's just stages. You'd go from stage to stage and have fun. Obviously, a lot of modern gamers, their hang-up is like, this game looks like shit. The game's visuals looks like something out of, like, the PS2 or PS3. It's like, who fucking cares? It's awesome to play. There's a lot of big fucking explosions and destruction. And it runs at a fucking decent... It's like at a lock 60 FPS, at least on my end, for my hardware. And you know what? There's nothing I could ask for more out of this series.
Yep. And it runs well on Steam Deck.
Nice. So. Yeah. So, you know, that's the biggest issue. Like, if the biggest issue is, like, this Epic login, if they can get that sorted out, everything will be fine. Like, I think... I believe this game has, like, the largest amount of stages in, like, a single EDF entry. I think it has, like... nearing 150 stages base, which is like already a lot of fucking stages, but I think with additional mission packs that'll come out in the future, it'll get it over to like over 200 stages, which is, that's quite a lot, you know, especially because these stages get tougher and tougher and with more and more enemy types as it introduces to you. So it's just hours of fun. Like, I'm like 15 hours in and I'm like at getting to like the third of, like, I think stage 30 around there, and I still have a lot to go. So, and I've been having just a ton of fun, like just hopping in with some friends, just, you know, having a good night, you know, just playing some stages, and just, you know, just, even if you're just like hopping into like just random lobbies or like creating a lobby, like people are more like, the population at the moment is like more than willing to help you out, you know, like, you know, playing through stages with strangers. And I think there's like, according to Steam charts, this has been the best performing EDF yet in terms of like just user number and user base, like just vastly outperforming, you know, previous EDF entries just based on Steam charts. You know, good to see. You know, like, just, you don't see these many types of games anymore. Just like very simple but fun games. I hope that, you know, yeah,
pick up and play.
Exactly. Know, yeah. Just, you know. Epic game store shenanigans aside, like I'm all for the EDF, just more EDF incoming, and no games as a service shenanigans. Mm-hmm. Hopefully Sandlot continues to find future success with EDF, because, you know, this it feels like this portion of the market continues to get underserved more and more as the games industry thrives on with games, which is kind of a shame, but I can see why. Even Helldivers 2 is a games as a service. You know, if you want to play that game single player, you still have to connect to a server with Helldivers 2.
Yep.
While in this game, you don't need to, like, you can play this game completely offline solo, and you'll be fine. You don't have to connect to a single server through that way either. So, and of course with Helldivers 2. It does have like that monthly pass of like, hey, if you want to get more stuff to get, like new weapons, new, it has that like battle, like it has like that weird battle pass system. It's like, it's a new battle pass per month, and then you pay for those on a monthly thing if you want the current lineup. And that, like, they're doing it in a very smart way, but at the end of the day, Helldivers 2 is still a games as a service.
Yeah, it's one of those things where nowadays we're like, well, as long as it has a generous battle pass, or, you know, but then Helldivers is like, or not Helldivers, Earth Defense Force is like, well, how about none? How about
why don't you just like play through the game normally without any of that? It's like, oh wow, what a novel concept. That's weird. it's always weird to like talk about it like that. You know, it's like having to describe a Walkman for example. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we're just getting old, but yeah, EDF, what more can you say about it? I'm gonna continue to play more of it until, like, you know, there's other releases that come out, but this will serve me for the time being. Like, I've just kind of been, it's been a good game to like not have to worry about RPG mechanics, don't have to worry about games as a service mechanics, don't have to worry about, you know, complicated game stuff. Just hop in, have fun. That's EDF.
Well, thank you, Josh, to talk about your time playing Earth Defense Force 6, and James, of course, to chime in with your short time with the game on Steam Deck. Before we go into the news, we do have a handful of features up on the site that I want to talk about. And this first one in particular is very cool. It's coming out of Anime Expo. So this is something that James was able to put together for us. And James, maybe instead of stealing your thunder, I'll let you key up what you were able to publish for us on RPG site this last week.
Yeah, so I got to interview Falcom's president, Toshihiro Kondo, again. The last time I did an in-person interview with him was 2019, so 5 years ago. So, inside baseball, we had a regular interview scheduled, and I don't know if it was like someone specific in NISA that came up with this idea, but because I play the games in Japanese, and because they know that I played both East 10 and Trails Through Daybreak at Japanese launch, they decide, oh, well, we can actually take advantage of this because you know what you're talking about with both of these games. Let's do something more like a conversational video podcast interview. So that's what we ended up doing, and got pushed on both the RPG site YouTube and the NIS America YouTube yesterday.
Yeah, this was a really cool, almost half hour, almost podcast interview, as you said, and it's focusing first on East and then Trails Through Daybreak, and you guys got you were able to connect almost the past to the present in this, because there's a really funny moment throughout that where Kondo was trying to remember East Origins names, where did that heroine show up again? Which East title did that? What was? This is
very funny stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but that's also where you learn where Kondo also was the scenario writer for East 10 that you didn't realize.
Yep.
Because you don't really see that much of just a CEO directly contributing as a scenario writer for a game these days. And it was just really, really a really cool opportunity. I was really happy for you being able to just have a sit down with Kondo about just what seems there's going to be upcoming titles or in Daybreak, it's already out, but at the time there was an upcoming title for the West with East 10.
Yep.
It's nice having to be able to speak about these titles not in a preview capacity where you already know sort of what the development process was and the mindset was going into these titles. So yep. You were able to have a more in-depth conversation with Kondo in regards to these two titles. It was such a cool thing.
And it's the exact opposite of our, the most limiting form of interview where you send in questions and get answers. You were able to sit down, get it all, video podcast on tape on our YouTube channel, which we don't really dabble in a lot outside of the podcast uploads. So very cool to see James and represent RPG site. And then of course, thanks to NIS America for kind of,
Special shout out to Alan Costa at NIS America. He is probably the best interpreter in the industry. He is incredible for what he does. The voiceover translation is him, and they just superimposed it over top, but he was on it instantly.
Yeah, so. it incredible editing work all around the in production, for sure. That's up, you said, on both our YouTube and on NIS America's YouTube. It's kind of a weird it's kind of weird seeing NIS America's YouTube. It's kind of there's the usual slew of press releases and for other upcoming titles, and all of a sudden just a special just in person interview with Kondo with our outlet and having that exclusive opportunity. It's I'm just so happy for you, James. I've just been spreading that video wherever I can, and
yeah, I spread it to all my friends, so
it's incredibly humbling and seeing that, I just think of oh my god, I wonder if I were to have that sort of similar opportunity, where would it be? Where's my expertise? I don't know if I'm I consider myself an expert.
Because Cygames has a Western branch in the US now, so
yeah, imagine. But that'd be Chow. Chow would be over there at Side Games because he's the Side Games expert.
Look, I'm checking out my Daybreak guide for like feedback, and I get a feedback from my Grand Blue guy. It's like, are you stupid? Why didn't you put a map in your videos?
For me, it's like I'd be like gassing up like other people that I know, like who are experts of like certain like companies and games and fields. Like, and for me, I'm just like, I don't know what I'm an expert of. I feel like I'm just looking at the mess of everything. That's me.
Like, of course I would put a map if there was one when the game first started.
Yeah, man. So that was really cool. Yeah, shout-outs to James, shout-outs to East America, shout-outs to Falcom for, you know, reaching out to us for that opportunity. If you haven't seen it, definitely check it out.
We learned something new. We learned that Kondo basically wrote Yeast 10, was it?
Yeah, scenario writer. Yeah, he also doesn't remember East Origin. That's what
the thing is, Kondo writes good stories. Mm-hmm. It's just that he's not being the man in charge most of the time now these days since he's president. So,
but he's still very deeply involved in each game's development process in some capacity. It's cool to see. Like, he's not only just serving his duties as a CEO, but he's also just, you know, even with their latest titles, still like almost in the trenches of like in that game development work. On top of the CEO role, which is pretty unique in terms of just modern game development, I'd say.
So, of course, do check out that interview. We have a link in our feature section on our website, and also if you just go to the RPG site YouTube, it'll be there as well. We do also have two other features up on the website at rpgsite.net. One of these is a review and one of these is a preview. So Scott, one of our contributors, was able to go to London, Ontario a few weeks back to head to TennoCon. TennoCon was not something that I had heard of before, but it's at Digital Extremes, the developer and publisher behind Warframe. So Scott was able to go there. I guess this is their 10-year anniversary, which to me seems like crazy. And we had not covered this game before, but it was something that Scott's been interested in. So, of course, we gave him the leash to cover it. Gave a preview of Soulframe, which is basically the fantasy sister counterpart to Warframe being developed by Digital Extremes. So not a game that I personally knew a whole lot about. Like, I'm not even in the Warframe sphere a lot, other than knowing that it has a very loyal fan base that Digital Extremes has done very well, kind of keeping that game fresh and exciting for ever since its launch 10 years ago. So so Soulframe is not a game that I know very well, but Scott was able to go hands-on and went to TennoCon and was able to write up a preview for us. So if that's something that you've been interested in, it's not something that we have typically covered on the site, but Scott was able to kind of, you know, stretch our viewpoint a little bit and put up a pretty nice, very thorough preview of that game. And of course, was able to talk about a little bit about his time over traveling to TennoCon to see that in person.
See, it seems very early from the footage that they released on that. I think this would have had a stronger showing if they showed it next year, a little bit more polished. Because at the moment, it feels that the reception is very divisive, especially when it comes to like the combat segments of what they showed, which is very, it seems very early, I'll say. being generous about it on that end, because I know, like, you know, these types of projects take time. But they have a lot of polishing to do for that game, I'd say.
The other feature we have up on the site is about another recent release that we've covered on the website before, and that is the Switch release of Tokyo Xanadu EX Plus that released just in the last week. So Cullen, our Switch expert, was able to cover this and write a review for us on the site. I guess it's an unscored review. It's more like an op-ed up on the site. And this is the kind of the notable thing about this is that it's kind of has the new translation that's what for those playing the game in English, what Colin was kind of focusing his preview around. Now, Adam, I know that you haven't played the newest version, so to speak, of this game, but you did. I saw you sharing on your Twitter page some just opinions that you had on the original English translation for Tokyo Xanadu.
Yeah, so basically Cullen's declaration here is that this is the best version to play in English because of the translation. And, you know, this game was originally a Vita game. I know the EX Plus version was like a PS4 game on PC. So this game isn't going to be like playable in 4K on a Switch, but apparently it is 60 frames per second, and it's good resolution and everything else on Switch. So his conclusion is, hey, this game runs great on Switch. It has an improved translation. It's the best version in English. So we've already got some people disagree with that for various reasons, including there's no achievements. But of course, I'm joking.
Hey, people value different things.
Right, exactly. But yeah, so I played the original version, and I always thought the translation was a little bit stiff. If you just go to my Twitter page, it explains better than I could here. Just the way that they phrase certain sentences and conversations are kind of weird. They quote a lot of words. It's very strange. I hope they tone that down a bit in the new translation and maybe have it flow better. But I never thought the original translation was like nonsense or undecipherable or anything like that. It was just kind of like read weirdly. And there is no English voice acting, so you are reading it. But anyways, I think we've talked about this before. I think Tokyo Xanadu is an interesting game. It's not necessarily stellar. It's not bad. I kind of appreciate that it's not Trails, even though it sort of is Trails. But
Trails Light, okay.
Yeah, the gameplay is a little different. But there is a sequel coming. So.
Yeah,
maybe next year in Japanese.
Yeah, I think that's the most like. I think that's the thing that'll like boost interest in this game.
Yeah, so play it now.
There's a new Xanadu project coming next year from Falcom. Who knows how that'll shape up? Hopefully,
still gonna give it a shot.
Hopefully better than Tokyo Xanadu. Like, it's not like Tokyo Xanadu is a bad game. Like,
it's not terrible, but you know, it's serviceable. I don't think I hate it. I have a decent time with it. It also has a good soundtrack, too.
Yeah, yeah, the soundtrack is honestly incredible, to be honest, in my opinion.
It's just kind of like the thing that I have high hopes on for the new Xanadu project is, like, hopefully the soundtrack is just as good as Tokyo Xanadu's. And you know, hopefully, I don't know what the verdict is on this in terms of, like, if Axis has the capacity to put updated localization script in, like the PC release or something like that. I don't know if they have the were able to. It'd be nice to see.
Worst thing that they didn't include is like when they first released it, it's like there was no English dub. I feel that's a missed opportunity. If you don't dub games these days, I feel that the game doesn't really take off and this kind of becomes forgotten these days, I think.
I think that's it. Like if they were to localize the new Xanadu project, obviously I think Nice America would probably be the ones to do it. And if they are the ones to do it, they're probably going to have English dub on. There's a lot of theoreticals, obviously.
Axis is really small relative.
Yeah.
Not that NIS America is huge, but I have a feeling that Axis is even a fraction of that.
Yeah, they probably don't have the budget to do that. But I don't know.
Yeah, but we'll see. But yeah, hopefully they find some way to have this updated localization script in like previous releases. Probably, I imagine what will happen is if Axis can't do it, I'm sure there'll be some fan mod.
I'm so glad someone else finished a guide for Tokyo Xanadu that I don't have to write it, because people are counting me on years of like, why won't you finish this stupid guide? I'm like...
So wait, Chao, did you finish your Daybreak guide? Is it done now?
It's technically done. I just forgot to list all the garments. I just need to...
What does technically done mean? What is this?
I had to list all these items, and there's like 400 different items. It's gonna take me a while to list all these items, okay? But the main story guide is done.
Is this pretty normal for guide writing, where you're like, finally done, and then you get reminded, oh, you never did this, and you gotta work all this time working on this list or whatever.
Yeah, but you know,
now I'm done, and then someone else reminds you, what about these? And you think you're done with
it. Like, if you've done the main story, the guide is considered done, you get paid for it. But those are just extra, you know?
Why did you list every single character interaction dialogue inside your guide?
Whatever. Look, people send me some comments like this. I hate to say it, it's stupid, because it's like, hey, can you tell me what NPC dialogue is important and which one is not? It's like, how am I supposed to know what's important?
That is a funny thing to say. Can you tell me which NPC dialogue is important?
While you're at it, can you explain the story as you go?
It's can like, you actually play the game for me, Chao?
Like, no.
I don't watch you.
Chao, can you tell me every reference what games I need to play in order to get it?
Yeah, when Ren says Estelle and Joshua, what did she mean by that in the dialogue?
They're related. How's that? Good enough.
For anyone who's confused listening right now, Chao writes guides for Neo Seeker mostly, and he's wrote other places in the past. He does some guides for us even, so
He's a legendary guide writer, you know.
Like, so. People thought it's like I retired or I'm dead. My favorite post is from a 4chan post saying that I got killed by the Wu virus. I'm like, what?
A lot of people think you're a woman too.
It's like, okay. There's all kinds of myths. I think the best thing is that if you don't talk about your personal life, people theorize who can this person be. Like next thing.
So like if I don't hear back from my friend who I watch anime with for a day, I assume they're dead. So that's how it is.
Look, I was going to make a joke. I don't know if it was tasteful or not. Like, clearly, Chao is, you know, there's a Japanese woman posting in English on Twitter. Like, that's just how it goes.
Chao doesn't have giving Twitter. Leaks.
That's a deep cut right there. Holy.
Giving leaks and stalking a game company office every week.
There you go.
Anyways, Tokyo Xanadu is now out on Switch.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Maybe I should replay it before the new Xanadu.
Yeah. I don't mind replaying it, but I don't know. It's just like... it's been like one reason why I didn't want to resume doing the guides. Like when you haven't played a game for like a year or a half, you kind of forget how to play it, and you're like in the middle of something, and you're like, "How do I play this again?" But I don't want to start from scratch.
I assume the new Xanadu project will probably need Tokyo Xanadu to have play, but you never know. You never know.
Do you think it'll be like kind of like an expanded Daybreak action system, like completely as a game? Do you think it would be?
I don't think it'll have any turn-based things at all. I think they want to keep Xanadu action.
No, but like the action part of like Daybreak, like I feel like action part in Daybreak is pretty fluid.
Honestly enough, Daybreak 2, kind of most battles, it's fine to just do action in Daybreak 2. They may have proved it.
So I talked about Daybreak about 2 weeks ago. One little tangent here, because I had said that I thought that the mix of action and turn-based worked really well. Because I saw the action as like leading into the turn base, you get your preemptive strike, so to speak. Yeah. Then I just, you know, obviously people are allowed their opinions completely, but then you have an opinion on something and then you read Reddit, maybe that's a mistake, and you're like, that it sucks, it's terrible, and you're like, ugh, like, am I wrong? That's my immediate reaction is when I see something like that. But like, no, I thought the action.
No, I've seen a lot of people share the same sentiment that the action, using that to take out like enemies that might be weaker than you, where you don't have to get into the turn-based mode, or just using it as a preemptive strike to, you know, get an advantage. I've heard that sentiment before, sharing your sentiment that it was a good mix.
Metaphor is going to have that where like,
yeah, metaphor is similar.
If you want to take out like an underleveled enemy, you can do it completely through action. You don't have to worry about the turn-based part of it. And they even have like ways to like expand like your action capabilities and metaphor that they've shown off in a previous stream where like you'll like different weapon or what's it called? The archetypes will have different capabilities in the action mode or something, you know. So I don't know.
Like, I feel like with a system like that, it's so different. So people are just having some knee-jerk reaction because of it. You know, it's just I feel there's a system that grows on you. It just takes a bit to kind of get warm up to it.
I think it's one of those things in Daybreak 1 where it's like it's infancy, right? It's a very basic implementation of it. Like it's because it's novel for its time. So the implementation of it will be basic because they want to build off of it and like find ways to like. Getting feedback of like what works and what doesn't, and what are some ways we can improve upon it. And I think that's a total normal. It's a totally normal thing for letting something grow, you know, over time and have improvements over time. Just because they didn't nail it or not fully fleshed out the first time, doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's basic in its implementation, and they will find ways to improve upon it over time. It's totally fine to let systems grow over time because people are still learning how to do it.
You know what they need to get rid of, though? You know, if there is Kai, get rid of stealth game, please. I hate stealth in my JRPGs, please.
Oh, I mean, they're still going to have the action the turn-based in
no, Kai, but like, have you...
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
there's a stealth mini game. I'm like, no, please don't bring stealth back.
So, I don't know. Like, I think having just weird knee-jerk reactions and say, like, oh, it's just... completely fucking awful on its first go is like it's kind of missing the point of like how games are allowed to like develop their ideas over time, let game development, you know.
It's like don't just scrap it just because you're like, oh, it's not what I'm used to. It's like then things have no room to grow. I mean,
there's just it's kind of weird when people have that mentality and like
it's a lot in game facts. Like I'm reading in game facts, it's like, oh my god, it's like people are not gelling with this because this is the one try to learn new things.
Yeah,
it's like, oh,
it is. Change bad, old good. The eternal.
You can't tell me that you're sick of playing like the Cold Steel Battle system after using it for like 10 years, can you? I mean,
bring back Walkmans.
That's right.
Oh, no.
In vinyls back, so, you know. That's just that, that's just how it is. Chain bad. Good.
So going into the news topics, there's not a lot here, but in some of these we kind of touched on in passing in the earlier conversations, so we'll kind of at least tee them up here and I'll not bury the lead any further. We talked a little bit about Dragon Age Veilguard, about its plans for PC release, not requiring the EA app. But BioWare and EA have also announced the English cast. So for those that are really, because they've been, for the whole marketing series of this game, ever since the rebranding to the Veilguard, they've been really zeroing in on who are the companions and now like who are voicing them, because of course they're kind of like mini celebrities in their own right. But a lot of these names I actually don't recognize, at least not directly, but there are some familiar names. Some of the biggest ones are Ali Hillis is reprising her role as Harding, who is a pretty major but not non-playable character in Inquisition. So of course she's kind of a fan favorite. You know, one of the highlights of the re-reveal for the Veilguard is the fact that Harding is playing a much more major playable role. Then there's a few other recognizable names here. I know Erika Ishii is an Apex Legend, Destiny 2. She has a lot of appearances on that Dropout channel subscription service that came out of College Humor. We got a few other names from like Fallout 4, Matthew Mercer, Zach Mendez, Jessica Clark, a few other names that I don't recognize here. We got the whole list up on our website. One cool thing here is that the main character, Rook, has four different options, basically two British, two North American, and you know, so two male, two female. So basically you have a lot of options for your voice.
That was the same for Inquisition, I guess.
I don't remember.
Played Inquisition yet, but I mentioned that, and Quentin, another writer for the site, mentioned that Inquisition was the same with four voices for the main character. So,
and I think a lot of that is to help support, like, you can, you know, pick a different race, and if you're playing as a half elf versus something else or a dwarf, the voice could be different. I don't actually know. Like, can you pick this? This shows how out of the loop I am. Can you pick race for Rook?
Yeah, you can.
That's been shown. Okay, I thought so. But like, no, Brian. It's all, you know, you can only play as a human. But,
no, Brian. No, I get it.
And that's in line with like the Dragon Age 1 and Inquisition, at least.
I have. Yeah, so we have. Just right. it's kind of a off-topic voice acting thing that made me chuckle this weekend, because San Diego Comic-Con is this weekend, and one of the DC was unveiling this new, like, Batman cartoon or OVA or something like that, but it's going to be like a series, and the voice for Batman is I apologize if I get this pronunciation wrong. It's like Alex Lee or Le. He's the voice of the protagonist in Persona 3 Reload. Also voices Luke from Street Fighter 6. So Alex Lee voices Batman in this new thing that they unveiled.
I was like, I thought I recognized that name. Oh, he voices the protagonist in English of Solo Leveling.
So Luke from Street Fighter 6 is now voicing Batman in this new
thing. I also know he's also Zenitsu in Demon Slayer, which is, if you're familiar with that, now. He like yells a ton, because Zenitsu won't stop yelling.
Nobody remembers his role in Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Oh, he's Sonon, yeah.
Yeah.
Rip Sonon.
So this is a totally completely off-topic tangential thing, but it's the voice acting thing that made me laugh.
Speaking of voice acting, SAG-AFTRA just went on strike. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I am not an expert on this, but basically, the way I understand it is, if you are a voice actor and you are part of the union, you cannot work on basically certain projects unless that game company like signs an interim agreement. So they can still hire these voice actors, but there has to be like an additional agreement that has to be made. And I've already seen some voice actors like mention, like, for example, Erika Lindbeck is a very popular voice actress. She was a Jessie in Final Fantasy Remake and a bunch of other things. And she basically said already she's been getting reached out by companies basically saying, yes, we do plan on signing this interim agreement so we can move forward with your role. But there's basically going to be a little extra hurdle for the foreseeable future for getting these union voice actors to to be to participate in these projects because they're striking. And the strike has a lot to do with AI. So I guess there is some language with AI recording or perhaps animations or mocap or whatever that this guild, SAG-AFTRA, wasn't pleased with. So they're striking. Seems to be a big component anyway. Again, I'm not an expert. That's just kind of what I've gathered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, more power to them. It really is sickening seeing how the companies are trying to, like, you know, basically get their voices into a database so they can, like, reproduce it through artificial
And there's, like, I know that there's also been some, and there's tons of little micro stories all over the place related to that. But obviously we've seen successful studios shutter and, you know, talented people lose their jobs. So the voice actors are also a component of that. So whatever they can do to help protect themselves in the looming face of AI, obviously, it's how can you not support that? And I saw Owlcat Games, the developer of the Pathfinder and Rogue Trader, had listed a job listing for, like, basically concept artists generating using AI, and they got a lot of pushback for that. And they kind of gave, at least the last update I saw was they gave an apology saying, well, nothing we're going to do is going to show up in the final game. But it's kind of like, well, that's not quite.
That's the whole point of concept art. No concept art shows up in the final game.
Even if you're using it for, like, storyboard generation or concept generation, that's still kind of...
That's a very Machiavellian move of view on it, you know? It's like, it's totally fine if it doesn't, like, show up in the final game. It's like, no, there's still the methods you got to get there still fucking counts, you know?
Yeah, because that could mean a lot of things. You could say, we generated it, and then we had an artist touch it up, and then that appeared in the final game. Or, you know, there's so many ways you could interpret
it. Yeah, there's so many loopholes you can exploit throughout of it, so...
So good on the SAG-AFTRA union for trying to
protect. I know a lot of these voice actors, oftentimes, just this is the modern era, do stuff on the side, whether it's like YouTube or whatnot. A lot of YouTubers have become voice actors and vice versa. Maybe, like, I know Alejandro Saab, who does a lot of voices. I think he was Akahiko in Persona 3 Reload. He does some YouTube on the side, and he was even saying, like, he has to, I believe someone told him this to me, that he has to be careful, like, what he even puts on YouTube on, like, his little side gig, because as a union member, he has to be careful. And I'm sure, like, people like ProZD probably also have to be careful in what they post on YouTube or whatnot, because he does voicing too, so it's tricky.
This is kind of off topic, but you know the ProZD, like, he plays, like, one of the main characters in the Dungeon Meshi, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that show?
Yeah, yes.
Remember that show?
It came out a few months ago.
You know the manga artist that wrote that story? I think she wanted to, like, hurry up and finish the manga so she could play Elden Ring.
Was that the artist who, like, loves Baldur's Gate 3?
Was it?
Baldur's
Gate 3? I could have sworn one of the manga artists.
It was definitely Baldur's Gate 3, because she drew, like, stuff like Shadowheart and Asterion. So
it's also the artist from the official Elden, like, there's an Elden Ring gag manga ongoing. They said that they're putting on hiatus so they can play the Shadow of the Urge.
It's like, dang.
Makes sense.
But was it the Dungeon Meshi mangaka writer who put out a list of, like, their favorite games, and it was actually, like, surprisingly varied, like,
there's global, like,
games of all sorts of genres. That's cool to me.
Dungeon Meshi.
She had Pathfinder art, like, for the Pathfinder characters. If I remember correctly, she had art of the first Pathfinder game, Kingmaker, and she had, like, art of the second Pathfinder game, Wrath of the Righteous, but she said, like, I haven't played this yet because it's not available in Japanese yet. It might have been that one.
It might have been that, yeah.
She was, like, waiting for a Japanese translation so they could play it. I think that's cool to me, personally.
I mean, we touched about it lightly, but it's just, like, I love seeing just, like, the how varied inspirations can be for some of, like, some of the greatest creatives in our modern time, you know, like, just seeing, like, it's just a good lesson, like, you know, having varied, getting into varied stuff and having your inspirations being varied of all genres, like, just only empowers your work, you know, because you have different perspectives, different angles, different approaches to that. It just makes your output even better.
Now, I know our website is purely RPGs, I say purely RPGs, as if that's not already really broad. I know. But like anyone who, I'll always find people who play like a variety of sub RPGs or, you know, from various countries or various styles of RPGs or whatnot, much more interesting than the people who are like, I love Persona and Final Fantasy. And it's like, okay, that's fine. Yeah. But that's pretty narrow. So anyway,
that's why I always try to, like, especially in our Game of the Year conversations, I try to like bring up like different smaller games, like maybe people haven't like checked out.
Play Wandering Sword.
That's right. But I always try my best to like try to like give that those smaller teams and smaller like niche games like some recognition, because like, you know, it's also easy for them to just fall under the radar. It's like, you know, there's so many cooler things coming out, and I know a lot of our audience is very honed in and focused on like Final Fantasy and Persona and all that stuff, and I get it and I love those things too. But I always try to, like, you know, give a voice to some of these like smaller things as well, because some of the smallest projects like do like the most creative things, because they're allowed to take on that risk to explore, you know, more like things that like bigger games aren't allowed to.
I mean, look at our podcast last week. We spoke of Dungeons of Hinterberg, Flintlock to the Dawn, Gestalt, Steven Cinder, and also Kinitsugami, which is a big company, but still a new IP. So, like, four games that are different and new. So
that reminds me, oh god, I know we were talking about bad headlines before this podcast, but because you mentioned Kinitsugami, I remember, I don't know which outlet had this as their headline, but they said Kinitsugami doesn't deserve to like exist in 2024, yet it does. It's like, what does that even mean? What do you mean
it doesn't exist? It means exactly what it said. It doesn't deserve to exist, but it does, okay?
It doesn't deserve to exist in 2024. What the fuck is... I hated that headline so much. Sorry.
We're on an outstanding tangent right now. What were we talking about?
Yeah, where are we?
We were talking about BioWare voice actors.
Oh, BioWare. Right. Okay, got it.
Yes.
We still don't know, like, the release date for this, right? Like, it's this year. I saw some people saying, like, September, but I was like, no, it's not.
It was rumored to be September at one point, but the closer we get, seems less and less
likely. I feel like it'd be a bad idea to say this is September now when you only have like a month of marketing you can do for it. Not a month and some change, I guess, but it can't be September, right? It'd be like the Immortals of AVM situation if you're doing that.
Mm-hmm. We have a few other news posts here. We have that Wuthering Waves, which came out on PC and mobile back in May, is at China Joy 2024 going on either right now or very recently. And this team at Kuro Games has shown off a in-development version of the PS5 version of the game. So the game will be coming at some point to PlayStation consoles, at least to PS5. So they're working on that. No release window or known date yet, but working on a console version of the game.
Yeah, I've been playing this. I'm still playing this. I don't know why I'm still. I like playing it. That's why.
Give me your account if you quit.
What's that?
I'm still debating. It's like, do I want to go hardcore? I love this character design so much. I was like,
I think that's why I keep playing, because like it feels like the new characters are like really interesting and cool to play. They all have like different interesting mechanics. Anyway, Wuthering Waves officially came out on mobile and PC on May 22nd. Ryan said there's no release date or window for the upcoming PS5 version. That's the only console they've announced it for. I don't know if it's coming anywhere else. But there is like some blurry off-camera footage of it running on PS5. It seemed to run well on it, so maybe it's like farther along than we think. I don't know what they're going to do in terms of like content parity, obviously, for this. Like, unlike how HoYoverse does it with like Zelda Zone Zero and Honkai Star Rail, where like everything's lined up content-wise and update-wise too. So it's like between mobile, PC, and the PlayStation versions, they're all synced up together. I don't know what they're going to do for Wuthering Waves.
Or they'll do the same thing. I mean, Honkai Star Rail released pretty late for the PS5. It was like...
I thought it came out the same day.
No, it came out like 6 months later. And it's like, really? It's already like, everyone's in the same patch. Sorry, if you miss out all that shit, well, that's too bad. And I think what happened they did is that they start to release like double character banners at the same time, like double limit character banners.
Oh, okay.
Trying to get people caught up. But at the same time, it's like they don't really get a lot of resources to start. So you're like, yeah, it still feels bad, but
It still does numbers though. Like when you think about like whenever PlayStation shows like a monthly spending on like the games, like there's always like a HoYoverse, like Genshin is like always there.
Yeah, it's always there. That's why they're not taking this shit off, right?
Yeah, The Sony is more than with open arms. They're like, yes, please bring your gacha games to our platform. Please spend on our platform. We love it.
I hate to like use that leaked document, but didn't they have that? I don't know, that Insomnia leaked one time and it basically reveals that they've made like 30% from the profits.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. They get a lot of money from like a good cut.
Definitely, this thing is here to stay, sadly, right?
But, I mean, look, that's it benefits everyone involved, right? It benefits Sony, it benefits to the publisher of that said game. Like, it's a win-win scenario in their eyes. So hey, if people want to play on those platforms and spend on them, it's more power to them, you know. That's their money, their time.
But yeah, if you ever do that, it's like there's one thing I do want to warn people about back then. But you know, if you play Honkai Star Rail, they have like a pre-order bonus. It is the most useless pre-order bonus, that where you spent $8. Do not do that.
I remember seeing that. Like, I don't know why they do it, but
it's a bunch of useless currency that you can earn in the game for free, and it's like it's asking people to spend $8. It's like don't do it. And I think the other caution for people, if they want to like move on to the PlayStation platform, it's like you probably better off making an account, a Google account first or something else, because if you like make it on PlayStation, you're probably locked into their ecosystem, and it's always going to be on that ecosystem. So just be cautious about that if you decide to make an account on these games.
Yeah, now that you brought it to my attention, I guess I'll keep an eye on like what Kuro Games does for the PlayStation 5 version. If they have like any weird like pre-order shit or like any stipulations to it. So it's like I am pretty knowledgeable on Wuthering Waves, whether I like it or not. I'm locked in. I'm at that point in the game where I've done everything, so now I'm grinding mats for skills. I even had to spend stamina on money because I'm running out of money to.
Oh, look, I did the same thing in Genshin. And people say, how can you have no money? I'm like, because I upgrade my skills, damn it.
Yeah, because I like my characters. I like them doing big numbers. That's why.
That's why I play Grand Blue still. I love seeing like 40 millions of fucking numbers in the screen.
I even dropped Zenless Zone Zero earlier this week.
Oh, I dropped that within 2 hours.
I just wasn't feeling it anymore.
The combat I play in Ruby is like 10 times better. It's like, how can you get me to convince me to play this game? It uses the HoYoverse's most greediest monetization. It's like, forget it.
Then I saw how long it'll take for them to actually like improve the combat in that game. It's like, oh, in version 1.1, 1.2, we're going to do this. It's like, that's all you're going to do. Never mind. I'm not excited.
I saw that game so fast.
Oddly enough, once they actually like gave like and transparency and insight of like their update schedule, what they're gonna do, I'm like, okay, I'm out. I can't do this. But I'll give that. It's also because I also want to make time for this Sword of Convalaria game coming out soon, and maybe I don't know. I don't know if I like it. I like strategy RPGs, so.
Man. I think they're fun. I think the only problem is, like, as a game where you have to play it, like, every day in the gacha game lifecycle, it becomes kind of like a chore. And once it becomes a chore, that's the moment that you need to install something.
That's not it. It's like, I didn't play Zenless Zone Zero for a day. Like, I didn't log in for the day. And I was like, man, if I'm getting to this and it feels like a chore, I should just uninstall immediately. That's the habit that I've gotten over the years. Playing these games, like the moment I feel like it's not for me anymore, I stop having fun, I should uninstall immediately. Don't even give it a second thought, and my life has gotten better for it.
Speaking of games that might become a chore, I don't know. I have actually no idea if that's true. before the podcast, you were talking about the streaming event for the Grand Blue anniversary and different announcements out of there. I don't know if we're talking about the mobile game.
They announced everything. A fighting game, everything's there. You know, no real link information. Okay. So I guess the game is basically done. right? So
tee it up for us, Josh and Chow. They had the Granblue anniversary stream. They announced a few things there. I don't know what they announced. I didn't watch it. But
it's not the anniversary stream. It's a summer stream.
They have different. Sorry.
It's different. Okay.
Yeah, I forgot this was it. That's my fault because I put it as anniversary stream ? But I forgot.
But yeah, it's a pretty big stream. It had a lot of announcement, but it feels like, oh my god, this feels like a cash grab everywhere. You see, it's like, this is monetized, this is monetized. Like, oh my god, what is
this? Okay, so this is basically for the browser / mobile game, like the base Granblue Fantasy game that we're talking about here. It feels like, okay, Chow, kind of briefly explain like what they're doing. Like, I guess they're adding more forms of monetization to this. And in terms of like just the general your reaction and like the general community's like response to this.
I think the community is not happy about it. Like the first thing, I think one of the major upset is they're doing a collab, right, with the slime anime. I reincarnated as slime, and apparently this thing is like you have to roll for them. They're actually gacha characters. They're not free characters anymore.
Right? So this unlike other in other gacha games, you might like other people who are like in used to other gacha games, they might be used to like rolling for them. And Granblue, when they do collaborations in Granblue, for years now, you've never had to roll for these characters. They were like, you just have to play through the events and you'll get them for free.
Yeah, basically, yeah, you get them. And now people are like, oh, what happened? They're meta. And the producer's like, yeah, they won't be meta. Don't worry about that. They say that shit all the time. They release these weapons that are like god tier broken that cost
you. It's unlike people who like play Epic 7, for example. They're used to like rolling for collaboration characters.
Yeah, because they're always broken. They're probably gone, right?
Yeah.
Or it's some oversight from the producers or the battle directors, because obviously they never play their own games. I mean, if they actually play their own games, they would. They already know this is gonna turn out bad, right?
No. I mean, like, I'm sure they play it, but they do it deliberately, right? I mean, I think it's kind of absurd, the notion of, like, a battle director probably plays their own games, so they probably know if their unit's going to be good or not.
I think in Epic 7, they fired the entire battle director team.
Okay, that's crazy. I didn't know that.
Like, one time they released, like, one, like, this unit was, like, so broken to the point, it's like, obviously, you did not play the Testus, right? So, I think that got the entire team fired, and they're like, yep, we're not doing something like this again or something like that, you know. But I'm just saying they probably never test their own games.
So in Granblue now with the slime, you do have to roll for
whatever
the collaboration characters are going to be, and then who. And then, but even though there are so it's kind of a weird thing. Like, so they're making assurances that these upcoming units aren't going to be like crazy power, crazy broken. So they're already kind of like almost kneecapping their upcoming collaboration then, because at some level they're disincentivizing people who like the gameplay to not roll for these characters then if they're not going to be that good.
But you know, it's like, and I'm trying to think what they said other, they're trying to like reassure the fan base is like, it's not on their end that they did it. It's a slime part that they did it. Like, you know, that company that owns the slime part demanded them to be like gacha. Like, I don't know. I feel like this is kind of like they say, he said, you know, kind of crap.
Yeah. Because like, how about all the other fucking collaboration IPs that you've gotten? Like, I'm sure some of them throughout the years, like, have wanted their character to be good, like, you know.
Yeah, they have, like, lots of collab before. They have Code Geass collab, they have One Piece collab. It's like, this is the first one that had these kind of demands? That's like, I call bullshit on that,
like,
right?
Even if they had these demands, like, it was you who had the final say on whether you're going to collab with them or not. It's not, like, something that, like, you found out after the fact. It's not like you're saying, You signed off on it. It's like, oh no, we have to go give into their demands now after we signed off on it. It's like, that seems absurd.
So it's like, yeah, the player base was not really happy about hearing these news. And then it's like, and then everything is like, it's like monetization. It's like, oh yeah, that music CD for this very popular character that they released, it was like, oh, it's a music CD, but it doesn't include the skin. You're selling the skin 2 months later for $30, and you're like, ooh. And then it's like,
and Cygames is usually like good about like bundling like goodies with their merchandise with Granblue traditionally too.
Yeah,
like, usually the Blu-ray Volume 1 sales for like Granblue are like really sky high because they had goodies with that.
But it's like, now you buy the music CD, you don't get, you just get a bunch of stickers instead for that character, like, but now you get the skin like a couple months in, and a skin costs you $30 or 3,000 yen, right?
This is a problem that you create in yourself because you conditioned your player base over the years to have this expectation already. So any of these practices that you're doing now, this is the way that you've conditioned your player base over the years. And you've only had yourself to blame because you've conditioned them to be.
And then, the internals, like they're like these super OP characters in the storyline that you kind of have to spend like a year grinding to get all these materials to get them to join you.
Yeah, the internals.
And then they're like selling them as like limited characters as well, coming soon. And you're like, what? Huh? It's like, yeah, they're in a different outfit, but you know, it's like.
Wait, so what do you mean by they're selling them? Like, are they selling like the characters you don't have to roll or like build them?
Yeah, the role. It's a gacha character. It's like, okay, imagine you could recruit Siate or Siafon in English names, right?
Right.
You basically, in the mobile game, you would grind all these different materials to get him to join you, right?
You spend a literal year in real time to basically.
Yes, because of the materials that requires to get them. It's like, oh, you have to do like thousands of battles just for them to join you, right? And then when they join you, it's like, yeah, they're super OP for its time, and they keep like adding like new ways to like power them up by grinding like more materials and shit, right? Mm-hmm. So they're kind of like worth your effort grinding, and now you can roll like a, you know, them maybe in a different outfit as a gacha limited character as well, and you're like,
oh yeah, and those characters that you use gacha for like automatically better than what like you farmed up for a year. Of course, you'd be pissed because
you're like, wondering, it's like, oh, that kind of kills their status of. Yeah. Their characters kind of way. I don't know. It's just like so much about their monetization. It's like they're trying to like grabbing like a burst of profit from like closing this game or something, you know? That's how I feel. It's like very aggressive monetization this stream, I would say. It's like
any other monetizing things that you wanted to share besides those?
They have Battle Pass skins for the fighting game. It's all swimsuit Belial. Now you can see him finally in his underwear, I guess.
Yeah. And they also have showed off like a summer
summer Beelzebub too. Yeah, all naked. Basically in the mobile game, he was all naked because after you basically kill him and destroy his body, he kind of like recreated his body again, and then he has no clothes on. That's basically it, right?
So for the people who play the base Grand Blue Fantasy, they're coming up on, I forgot if this is the 10th year or tomorrow.
It's already a 10-year anniversary.
Party. Okay, so this year's a 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, there was a 10-year anniversary event. I don't really like the 10-year anniversary event. I mean, some people like praise it. Some people see it as like the biggest cop-out because they kind of retconned this entire storyline in order to make it work. And people's like, oh, it's not a retcon because that was just part of the plan. I'm like, how could this be part of the plan? This feels
like how does the community feel like after, you know, 10 years later, now they're doing all this shit at the 10-year mark? Is there at least some fears within the community? It's like, oh, they're really trying to just like kind of cash out before they kind of start.
There are those kind of fears. I think the gacha character is probably the limited collab is probably what scares them the most, right? Mm. I mean, the player base are really hooked into Grand Blue. They're willing to spend anything. But this is like the first time I've ever even seen like the most diehards are kind of like.
But there's also one little thing that they announced before that stream ended. Right before that ended.
The producer's announcing that he's leaving.
Yeah, so Kimura has been the producer of Grand Blue Fantasy, like the base game, for how many years now?
I think 7, I think.
So this is a pretty big departure because he's kind of been, along with Fukuhara, like the face of like the Grand Blue like base game. So him stepping down is sort of a big deal because who knows what the new producer, whoever that will replace him.
There was like a substitute producer that did that was there for like 3 years ago, and people say like the game has been aggressively worse since, you know, if these ideas came from that guy, it's like, yeah, the game's been going worse if that guy was in charge. That's what
you have to imagine. Like, whoever is the replacement, they're like, okay, I'm now in charge of producing this thing that's been going on for 10 years. They'll probably start looking at, like, okay,
it's gonna end up like Dragalia Lost when the new guy took over. The game just died within a year.
Yeah, so I imagine, like, people are rightly should be concerned, like, hey, can we really trust this? Because now they have to place distrust in like a new producer. That who knows how long they have, what their track record is, whoever decides to replace them, and then they have to trust them, like, okay, can you keep the ship running for however many years now? You know? It's gonna be interesting to see how this shakes up, because Side Games has also been expanding globally as well. They have a Side Games America and a Side Games Europe branch now as well, and they're slowly starting to reach out to, like, the international community to keep on going, like, you know, with the fighting game versus Rising, with Relink, their action RPG. And then they also have, like, you know, upcoming localizations in the West for Uma Musume.
They also have, like, the sequel to their card game, Shadowverse.
You know, like, they're starting to introduce new ways that they're not just solely leaning on the browser or mobile game.
Yeah.
Incoming revenue.
I mean, like, you kind of have a very old game to sustain your product. But at the same time, it's also like, it feels kind of depressing to hear all this, like, thing happening, you know?
I mean, it's like, in a way, they're like the old guard of mobile games, like with Granblue Fantasy and even Fate Grand Order. There is some sort of, like, we can't keep up, we can't stay competitive anymore, you know? Like, we see a lot of, like, mobile games of, like, that old era shutting down, like, Tales of the Maze.
Those games just are not sustainable. People want, like, the flash shit these days. Yeah. They want, like, HoYoverse-style type kind of games now. Yeah, like, everything is just copying them these days, right?
Just this past week, like, Tales of the Maze, like, has been going on forever, and that shut down in Japan just recently, too.
Damn, so, already shut down.
It's finally shut down. No, just recently
shut down. Even Roll Flippers was shut down.
Yeah, Roll Flipper. Yeah, that was another Side Games property that shut down as well. So just, you know, it's at some point, you know, these old guards of, like, old mobile games, like, I think they see the writing on the wall that, like, I don't know what, like, I'm really interested to see what Lasengel and is gonna do with Fate Grand Order, because they have to know, like, this can't is there gonna be another 5 to 7 years for Fate Grand Order? You know, like. If they sunset that, what's the next thing to keep them running?
I don't know. I hate to say it, but I feel that fan base is like a cult, so they'll keep the game running no matter what.
You're not wrong. I don't think they can keep on running it for as long as they have been. I think it just gets the line is gonna come down. Nothing lasts forever, you know.
But with all their budget, it's like, can you imagine if they made, like, some kind of AAA gacha game? What would it look like with Fate property?
I have no idea, dude. They have a lot of fucking money to play around with, but I think it all comes down to talent, the developers right there, like, what you can produce next. You know, I think they do have they sure as shit have the money flow. So I think the sky's the limit, what they're able to do. I have no idea what would be sustainable, though. I think that's the hard part about it, is, like, you do not want to make a one-off console project, because that only has, like, a limited cash flow to it. I don't know what you have no idea what you would need to do to, like, make a new project that has as a sustainable cash flow as Fate Grand Order. Is that even, like, possible? I don't know. Because if you try to make like a Genshin clone, you know, with Fate characters, like, that'll be successful, but only for so long. I don't think you can really replicate the success.
I think people say the same thing with Roaring Waves. They think a lot of people kind of make, like, Doom posting when the game first came out, and then it just makes, just, you know, like, $30 million within the first month.
I mean, but I don't know. I don't know whether Wuthering Waves can replicate the success that Genshin did, because, like, Genshin hit at a point where, like, remember, it was in 2020, it was during pandemic. You know, so
yeah, I don't think it'll reach Genshin numbers, but the game is more successful for people to give it credit for, you know.
But yeah, but Genshin is a lot of people's first gacha game. That's kind of, like, the main driving point I'm trying to hit home here, is, like, Genshin was an entry point for a lot of people and a very much a turning point for the entire industry in that sector, right? So, like people's expectation of what one of these games should be, their base level expectation is what Genshin is, you know, which is already a crazy fucking expectation to have. But, you know, but that's how it is, because that's their first game, so they expect, like, every other fucking game from this point onward to have that, to surpass Genshin.
It's gonna be dead on arrival if it doesn't reach the same quality on demand, right?
Like, that's why you have things like Neverness to Everness and Project Mugen.
There's, like, Azure Promophia, whatever it's called.
Then Wuthering. You know, so it's Genshin just came and just released at such a perfect time frame, because everyone was indoors and a lot of those people. You know, it's like, this is what a free game can be these days. Holy shit. You know, remember that a lot of these people didn't pay a fucking cent for Genshin to just like get exposed to it.
Yeah, like, well, so you can play all this shit for free, but I don't like the free business model, obviously, because it's like, yeah, I like to have end game. I like to have all the characters, but obviously they're selling you the characters.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure a lot of those, like a good chunk of those people, like, not a good chunk, but like a small chunk of those people, like, spent a fucking shitload on Genshin. It's like, oh, you know, but I'm having fun with it. And the amount of if I could feed more money into this game to have more fun with it, I will. You know.
Yeah. But so they don't know. They're telling you an incomplete game is free.
More money equals more fun. Sign me up. You know. So it's just it is what it is. But I don't know how you replicate that success with Genshin, or I don't know how you replicate Genshin's success. I don't know how you replicate FGO's success. It's
like the whole thing that you hear with like WoW versus Final Fantasy 14. Yeah. It's like the WoW's killer is themselves. It's nothing. It's not competition.
It's like both of them have like are such weird anomalies. Especially like, you know, Fate from the get go was like a doomed project. Like in its first 6 months in Japan, like that shit was not good.
Yeah,
and by all accounts, it should have fucking sunk.
But it should have failed on dead on arrival. But yeah,
but it didn't because of the strength of its fan base. Was like, you know, the Fate fan base was just like, oh my god, this will be Kino money. And
this will be Kino shit one enough, day.
You know,
it only took like 8 months.
I mean, it took so fucking long for it to like. It was so bad at release. Like I played Fate Grand Order in Japan, like the Japanese launch for like 4 months, like its first 4 months, it was so fucking dire, man. It was so fucking bad. Like I cannot like stress enough how bad it was. It played so slow. You didn't get double speed and Fate Go for like 2 to 3 months, and since launch, like it should have fucking died, but it didn't. And it persevered because of the promise of it. Because people are like, I want to see new historical figures. What this team can do with new historical figures, and what sort of like, you know, stories it'll have. It's kind of just that weird phenomenon. Like the strength of its fan base, its loyalty, like was like far, just outpaced anything. any doubt for misforgiving people had, or misgiving people had with FGO, their loyalty to the IP far outweighed any sort of downfalls FGO had. And it's just like, it's so crazy.
That's why I say it's a cult.
I mean, like I said, you're not wrong when you it tracks. I have no idea. Were we on a podcast? I forgot.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Where are we?
I mean, I'll be honest. Like, there's the term "people watching." Listening to you and Chow talk about Fate stuff is just—it's like people listening. Like, I'm just enjoying hearing you guys like have history with this, have experience with it, have fervor for it. You know,
me and Chow are just like we're just like old heads talking about like the past, present, and future. We're kind of like we're like the old sages and wizards, like living in a treehouse, like, oh yes, back in the day.
Let me do my best attempt to segue that into the next topic, which is related. It's about the long slumbering remaster of Fate Extra Record. So this game, I had to remind myself exactly what it was because I hadn't seen it like mentioned in a while. So the Fate Extra released on PSP like 2010, and then this remake was announced like 5 years ago but had kind of been dark. However, it's got a new trailer as of this week.
They called it a sneak peek trailer because they're gonna properly unveil more information about this game during the Fate Grand Order Fest event in Japan that celebrates the anniversary of Fate Go in Japan. I think it's like its 9 year anniversary now, which is god. They send you information will come for Fate Extra Record on August 4th. This is pretty much like guaranteed to be like at least released in Japanese and English because they have the official site in English as well. And obviously, this new information was announced in English too, along with the Japanese information. So, you know, they just provided new artwork of all the servants appearing in the game of Saber, Caster, Archer. And so forth, and then they also did confirm, you know, subtly through this new sneak peek trailer that Arcuade from Tsukihime will be appearing. They like, she already did as an optional boss in the old one, but people didn't know if she would in this new one. But you know, They showed her off her artwork, but still rocking the long, her classic long skirt, unlike the remake's design with the short skirt. It's going to be exciting to see what they have to show. Hopefully they'll finally confirm platforms and a release date for this game, because up until this point, we don't know what platforms it'll release on, and obviously we don't have a release date. But the last we heard about this game was like a brief trailer, like in 2022. And even before that, they like showed, like when they first announced this game, they just had like a very early prototype build of it they showed off. So it's gonna be, I don't know, I'm interested, you know. And like Fate Extra is an interesting game because it had like a really, really cool story, but its gameplay was so dire. Like a lot of people just hated the gameplay PSP. So we'll see.
I feel like the thing I remember the aspect is the visual novel type kind of storytelling from what I remembered.
It did have a visual novel type storytelling in its one. But I mean a lot of people welcome that. It's just like the rock, paper, scissors nature. Because like the PSP is like a turn-based battle system, usually a 1v1 duel. But like, you had to like find out what the enemy would throw out, a rock, paper, or scissors, because there's like direct counters for like you can play through that game without ever getting hit and like basically perfecting the opponent if you know their move set. So a lot of the game is like finding out what the enemy's move set is going to be, pretty much to counter. And it just didn't make for a fun battle system overall for a lot of people. So we'll see what they introduce in this upcoming remake to shake that up and make it more exciting on that end. They shot off like some prototype gameplay, but it was hard to like kind of get a sense
make out
of, like,
from
you know,
it.
Yeah, what the final game will be like. You know, it's a lot of prototype gameplay.
Yeah, watching a trailer, it's like I can't see anything out of this. It's just like, oh, just art basically.
Yeah, they have like older trailers that show some gameplay, but I don't know if it's like final gameplay or just like or representative of what the final product will be like. It's so hard to guess. So you know, next podcast or maybe next podcast or the podcast after that, we'll see all this new information. We'll see.
Couple other updates for some already released games. Stellar Blade is going to get a limited summer event where you can get have a new access to a new area called the Oasis. Have access to a few new outfits, so the which seems kind of like a normal typical update, but just the only thing that's kind of interesting here is that it is a single player game with a limited time event.
And yeah, that's really weird.
This is a game that's obviously focused a lot on having the cosmetics for your character, like some that are only available on New Game Plus. We talked about that, and so adding more outfits to the game, very expected, but it's like kind of also trying to get that FOMO where
is it limited time
vacation.
Yeah, it's limited time, they said.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Kind of weird. So from what I can tell, it's like it's with Clyde. Clyde is this NPC that basically teaches you about fishing. So I'm guessing to get these outfits is all about fishing. So
great. I mean, but it's cool that they're adding this. It's just, why make it limited time? Why not just have it there permanently?
I mean, they do the same thing in Final Fantasy XIV. I mean, they give you free outfits, but they're limited.
This is not an MMO.
But now you're forced to come back to the game because you want those outfits, right?
I don't. This is sort of related, and I don't know how big a thing this was or not. But apparently, Final Fantasy XIV, there was like a collaboration with like a boba tea place that
it's ongoing
did not work, or it was.
I actually went to that place during the collab, but they don't have anything like that in Canada. So
I heard that they had like. Not barely any codes to share and way too many
27 coupons, I think it's all gone. Yeah, like in the okay. second
yeah so yeah the horror stories I heard is basically people like, hey, I want like three boba teas, and since you got three, you'll get three codes. It's not like one code per
it's customer. Supposed to be one code per,
yeah, but for a lot of places they didn't adhere to that, so you hear a lot of horror stories out of that.
I think people have complaints, like, it's like, how can you run out of codes for a digital item? It's like...
And, yeah, it's also just, like a small amount of codes, like you said earlier, like one place, like, reported, like, they only had, like, 27 codes for it, so, like, if there are, like, 100 customers, a shitload of them are not gonna be happy, you know?
Yeah, it was a shit show. It's like, I don't think they have done any collab that worked out kind of well in the real
life. It's also one of those weird things, like you know, you can just generate, like, I assume on Square Enix's side, you know, they can just generate.
They print new them. Code. They literally have them on slips that you have to pick up at the store.
Ay, ay, ay. This seems not well thought out.
Hopefully they get their things sorted eventually.
Maybe on the next collab.
What would it be?
This is not related to anything, but Guild Wars 2, which did do one with Kung Fu Tea, also did one with Quiznos. We're like, but I hate Quiznos.
Wait, Quiznos still exists? I thought they're gone.
I think Midwest Limited or I don't know.
There's like Quiznos around here too.
Or like buying Butterfinger for the 7 remake. It's like, I hate Butterfinger, but I'll do it for the.
Yeah, I ate Butterfinger too. It was the worst chocolate bar I ate in my life.
Or whatever. And then of course it's like, well, you don't have to eat it. It's like, well, but if I already have it, I'm just kidding. Anyways, we're getting off topic. Stellar Blade, there's two new outfits, there's new like background music and new shops. I'm reading the Gamatsu article for it. It doesn't actually say dates, it's just that it has been added for a limited time. I don't know if
it's now available. It's not, it says, given, so it's on the menu.
Like,
but I don't know,
it's limited, we don't know the dates.
Yeah,
so if you want those outfits, boot up your game.
Maybe it's like a note inside the game or something. I'm not sure exactly. Yeah, so weird. Yeah, I don't like that it's limited time, man. Hopefully a lot of people complain and they're like, okay, let's not make this limited time.
You know what they usually do when they do limited time outfits? They usually would sell them later if, you know, you missed out on them. But you get them for free if you get them during the time when it was FOMO.
And well, you know what? You know, I'll just wait for the PC release. You know, what's limited time mean? Not buying this on PS5. Limited time for PC.
Yeah, it's good to be a PC gamer. I wish everything's on PC. Where's my Final Fantasy VII Rebirth on PC?
Oh, probably next year.
I guess I didn't think about that. Final Fantasy sixteen, like, it had a lot of that PC talk and then kind of died down a bit. So I don't know when we'll see that.
Yeah, because they said, like, yeah, we're working on a PC release, and it's like, it's one of those like weird marketing cycles where, like, it seemed like they were primed to like release it soon, and then they just like went totally silent on it.
Yeah, that's what I was meaning. Like, that never actually happened. Like, it felt like it was building momentum, and then it didn't happen.
Maybe they're just testing the market with the Kingdom Hearts Steam version first.
I've heard when 16 is hitting PC, but I'm not supposed to say. I'll just leave it at that.
What a tease. Nice teaser. Sneak peek.
2025, Feb.
Shadow Drop 16.
Yeah, Shadow Drop. Here we go. That'd be so sick, actually. Oh my god. That'd be so funny if they Shadow Drop 16.
Shadow Drop 16.
Oh, I would laugh so hard. I kind of want it to happen now.
All right. The last update that we have before going through some release dates at the end is that we did get another kind of newsletter website update for Phantom Brave, The Lost Hero. This was the Phantom Brave title that was announced at the Nintendo Direct earlier this year. So NAS America basically dumped some character bios, some character art, and some screenshots for Phantom Brave and The Lost Hero just in this last week. Adam, you just put this site up for us. Any points of interest on this?
I haven't played the original yet. I've started it forever ago and just never really got around to it. And now with a sequel, I'll probably try to do that. I know Ash and Marona are returning characters from the original game. There's also a character named Apricot, who is like a pirate girl. I don't know if she's new.
I think she's new.
So those are like the main three characters. You have Ash, who's like a dead guardian spirit guy. And then you have Marona, who is sort of like main heroine girl. She can speak with phantoms. And then Apricot is a pirate. She's got a cute little pirate hat and pirate coat. She says she's a lonely pirate girl who longs to reunite with her father.
If I believe right, in the Japanese version, I believe Marona's voiced by Kaori Mishi. Oh, is it Mizu? She has, like, the same voice as Laharo. I think they have, like, the same voice actress, like, voice all their main characters in, like, most of their, like, official Nisa game back in the day. I think that's how it goes. But I'm trying to remember.
Anyways, this is just a quick update. So last month they announced the sequel. James played it somewhere. I forget if it was at NAS's offices or at Anime Expo.
Anime Expo.
Okay, and it's coming out next year. It's coming out for Switch, PlayStation 4, and PlayStation 5 earlier. Seems like relatively early in the year, and then PC later, according to their website and press release. So it comes out on PC, but after. So this is just a quick update, basically saying, hey, here are the characters, and here's some screenshots. So nothing huge, but, you know, just... It's a colorful-looking game. It's got that 3D art style that recent NIS games have had, like Disgaea 6 and 7. So, yeah. Looks colorful, looks cute.
I got a French jump scare on some of the screenshots. I was scrolling the screen, I was like, oh, some of them are in French.
Some of them are French.
Right.
Oh, did I upload some of the French ones? Whoops.
Hello?
Whoop.
Who knows, maybe we have a French audience listen to this podcast. Maybe we'll start speaking French.
Like, thank you for the French assets, let's go.
Look, somebody in Neo Seeker rewrote my entire guide in French for the Rune Factory guide for some weird reason.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. There's like a link to the French version. I'm like, right. Why did someone went to this whole effort rewriting my entire guide in French?
Yo, the French go hard like that, okay?
Reminds me of that scene in Canadian Bacon, the John Candy movie, where they had to put French underneath the graffiti on the side of the truck.
This is why Canada went broke, because they tried to like redo all the signs to have two languages, okay?
Okay, so we have a few more. We'll have some release dates or dates of some flavor to wrap up this podcast. This one came out on July 24th, so a few days at the time of recording and about a week at the time you guys are hearing this. But Rise of the Ronin, obviously released earlier as a PS5 exclusive, now has a demo available on PS5. And the demo goes through, I believe, Chapter 1 and does carry over to if you purchase the full game, your demo progress will carry over. So if you were interested in Rise of the Ronin but had too many games to play in March or just hadn't gotten around to it yet, now it does have a demo available on PlayStation 5.
Yeah, I highly recommend it if you're interested. It's a really cool game. I think, you know, having... It's kind of like... I mean, this is not the first time Koei Tecmo has done this.
They did that with the Fate Samurai. Yeah. It's like, I feel that's so weird. Yeah. It's like, don't you want to like get people to play the demo before the game comes out so you get hooked into it?
Maybe I'm stupid, but...
I want to see some reverse psychology here.
I don't know.
I think we have a late demo is better, like better late than never, but still it'd be better to do it earlier.
Yeah, I don't know why they do the late demo thing. Like, I'm trying to think. Like, besides this and Fate, do you recall, Adam, if like they've done this in any other recent thing?
Banishers.
Oh yeah, they did. Well, I mean, it's not quite Tecmo, but yeah.
Oh, I thought you just meant recent demos that came out later. Yeah, that was one. Yeah, I remember.
Yes.
And by the way, I was just looking up this Phantom Brave like media kit that I uploaded screenshots, and yeah, some of them were in French. I didn't even realize. Okay,
hell yeah,
put them all together.
No,
what's RPG site called in French?
I don't know, man. Don't give me a French quiz here.
I was gonna make a joke, but I'm not clever enough. I don't want to insult anyone with my terrible fake French accent. Anyways, to wrap up, we have a few August dates here. Bleak Faith Forsaken, this is a Souls-like that released on PC back in 2023, will release on consoles, PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series, on August 6th. Tribe 9, this is the game that has the same art director as, what's the name of it? Danganronpa and what's the more recent visual novel? That's it, Code Rain. Yeah, so Tribe 9, we talked about this. It was announced back in June. Got a new gameplay trailer that basically details all the 17... Oh, wait, no. Oh, yeah, that is new.
It reveals 17 characters that show up in the beta test. I think there are even more characters than that eventually, but these are like
there you go.
The first 17.
The first 17.
What confused me is that it's two news articles that are like 3 days apart. One is announced the global beta test on August 9th, and then one is a trailer for the 17 characters in the beta test. So that's what confused me. But yeah, on August 9th, there'll be a beta test for Tribe 9 from Akatsuki Games.
Now, what's the other game that has Danganronpa art? It has a weird title, like 100 Army something?
Weird Academy thing.
Oh, yeah, I don't the 100 Lion Lance Last Defense Academy. Okay.
Right.
So that game is more like strategy, RPG, kind of tower defense-ish even. And that's like, from what I can tell, a normal priced game, I think. It's like coming to Switch and PC. Whereas Tribe Nine is like a free-to-play thing. Yeah. Okay, I mean, it's like there's these two games that look similar because they have the same character artist. I'm just trying to remember which is which again. Okay. Yeah. They're both from... one is from Akatsuki Games and Tukio Games, and the other is Media Vision and Tukio Games. Okay.
Mm. I don't know, the way I'm looking at the art, and then I read the VAs, like, that doesn't feel like those VAs at all.
Try to go play it and find out for yourself.
Hey, maybe some of these voice actors have better range than you anticipate.
That's right. You remember the Code Geass voice acting list, right, Chao? The inverse the roles?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that whole story. That just reminds you of that. It's like, okay, that's the reason why they do this, because they want to betray your expectations.
But yeah, I'm just looking at like this one character who's voiced by Toshiyuki Morikawa, which is the Sephiroth's voice. So I'm like looking at him.
He's not ready to descend from, you know, some shrine place with a blade.
It's like better press F.
Last thing we have is that Gundam Breaker 4 will have a second open network test in mid-August, on August 10th.
I mean, that's cool. That's going to be a second open network test. I mean, like, that's just kind of unexpected and out of nowhere, but sure.
Didn't you just get to play a beta already in Anime Expo?
That's Judge James who played it at Anime Expo. But I played a closed beta test months ago. That was only in Japan. Then I played the first open network test. That was like a week ago, I think. Like, yeah. And then out of nowhere, they're like, oh yeah, we're having a second open test. And then they announced some like new Gundams coming to it. Like they announced the three Gundams that the Destiny druggies use, the Chaos Abyss and Gaia. I call them the Destiny druggies.
Nobody knows their names. They just call them druggies. Every person I talk to is like, hey, do you remember the names of the druggies in Gundam Seed? Like, no, I don't. I just call them druggies because they're drug addicts.
Stella! Oh my god. I was thinking about this the other day. Stella, and then Auel, A-U-E-L, and then Orga?
Olga. I remember Olga. Because I remember that line where he's like, what the? And I'm like, I got you. And then he gets fucking like,
I forgot if Orga was the original druggies or Destiny druggies. I already forgot.
I think he's a Destiny druggie.
I don't remember. All the Destiny fanboys would be like, oh my god, I can't believe you don't remember the druggies' names.
Okay, I only remember one druggie in the original Seed, which is Shani, which is the guy with the Forbidden Gundam with the barrier Shani, and shit.
Clotho, and I think Orga was a the original druggie, and I don't remember the Destiny druggie one.
Damn, we almost got through it by a process of elimination, but we failed.
We're so bad at names. That's it. We're fake Gundam fans.
Look, it took one of my best friends a year to remember my name. Like, how can you take a year to remember my name?
He took a year to remember your name?
You say he was bad with names. It's like, yeah, it took me a year to remember your name. Like, we sit in the same class together.
Dang. That's rough. I mean, I'm really bad with names, but I don't know. I'm really bad with names, but that might be worse than me. That's crazy. Yeah. Sorry.
With that, we've covered all the news on the podcast. Somehow, we still managed to get 2.5 hours out of a relatively quiet week. All we got to do is just let Chow and Josh talk about.
We talk so bad. We're so sorry,
guys. I don't mind. I kind of earmarked this time out, so we'll talk regardless of what the topic is. But yeah. So do obviously check out James's interview up on RPGsite.net on our YouTube channel. We also do have the Soul Frame and the Tokyo Xanadu reviews up on the site, RPGsite.net. All the news we talked about, of course, is up on the site as well. You can join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite, or hit the link at the top of our homepage. We're on most of the social media networks. Just search for RPGsite and you should be able to find us. Next week, we'll probably be talking about Sword of Khan Valaria, I assume, as our main topic, and then whatever else, you know, we'll wing it, as we always do, whatever else comes to mind.
What else comes out next week? I don't know.
Some VR game, maybe? I don't know. My brother gave me his Meta Quest 2 because he bought Meta Quest 3, and I don't even know what the hell to use it for.
Star Wars Bounty Hunter. You should play Thrasher, the sequel to Thumper, which came out this week.
Huh.
There you go.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah, I didn't know there was a sequel to Thumper. That's cool.
One Piece Odyssey came out on Switch.
Oh, shit.
Recording.
We don't play anime adaptations, okay, guys?
Yeah, so Sword of Khan Valaria will be the big one for our website, but we'll see what else people kind of get up to in the next week, and we'll talk about it a week from today. Well, as always, thank you all so much for listening. If you do listen to this podcast, leave us a like, leave us a rating, leave us a comment. We'd like to see those. We'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.